Okay, I think we can start as a subcommittee, since most of what we're going to do is holding things for inclusion in the omnibus bill, so there won't really be formal votes. Reverend Hilstrom, you have two bills, one we're going to deal with later today, later in our process. And the first one, then, is 1309.
Correct.
Yes. I guess I'll move that House File 1309 be laid over for, I have a quorum yet, so just start talking about it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill was brought to me by the State Auditor, and it defines political subdivisions and special districts for the purposes of laws governing the State Auditor. And with me is the State Auditor, so I'd just like to turn it over.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, thanks for having us today. My name is Rebecca Otto, and I'm the State Auditor. The last name is OTTO. House File 1309 is a good government bill. It's basically kind of a cleanup bill and clarifies some things. Section 1 of the bill clarifies and cleans up Chapter 6 by creating a uniform definition of political subdivision for local units of government. Section 2 took out some archaic language. Section 19 requires that newly created special districts to notify the state auditor's office of their formation. Currently, there is no listing of special districts in the state, and it's difficult to know exactly how many exist today. We do a report on special districts, and there was no way for us to figure out who they were or where they were. So now we're testing newly created ones for that they report to us. Section 19 also makes the audit requirements of special districts consistent with those of other local units of government. It also promotes timeliness by setting a guideline for presentation of the audit to the governing board. There's some inconsistent requirements right now. We're just trying to make sure everyone knows what they should do. Section 21 removes some more archaic language. And it also makes clear the state auditor's authority with respect to watershed districts, consistent with the state auditor's general authority over other political subdivisions. Section 22 repeals an old definition of political subdivision. And we changed, we added the phrase or chief administrative officer to cover local governments. Do not have a person with the title of clerk or as a chief administrator. Oh, no, as chief administrator.
I'm sorry, I'm talking quickly.
So basically, this just cleans stuff up. It will not create a cost for our office
because we already
work with special districts. And so I'm happy to answer any questions. Okay.
Any questions of the auditor or of the author? Okay. Well, if there's no further objection, we'll hold us over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And some of these we may end up sending out separately and including, but we'll deal with that as we put the bill together.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Paulson, that's easy. Representative Paulson. Representative Paulson.
Madam Chair, and there is an author's amendment to the bill, and I don't know if you have a quorum yet, if you need to move the amendment or do it later, or
explain the bill and Chair, the amendment.
Members, the bill essentially would provide a public searchable database online for Minnesota residents or any resident, anyone actually, to look online to find out what state grants are being made available, a searchable database that would be available for constituents to use in identifying where a state government is devoting resources to. It's really an open about openness in government, and it's proceeding on a bipartisan basis. There are other states that are looking into doing the similar initiative. This is based on an idea I've been looking into this last summer that Senator Barack Obama and Senator Tom Coburn had done in the U.S. Senate, actually. This is modeled after that. And so originally the bill, Madam Chair, went back and had a 10-year lookup for providing some historical data to look at some patterns that have been done over previous years. But I think there have been some concerns in my conversations with the Department of Administration about potential cost to that and having an impact there. So the amendment that is before you actually would just be from a point now going forward and eliminate that 10-year lookup, and also making sure that we're looking at grants or contracts that are valued at more than $25,000. And that's kind of what the federal legislation is based after, and that's what the amendment would do, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Paulson, are there any questions? Representative Paulson. Okay. I'm sure that there's no problem with either the bill or the amendment, so as soon as we get a quorum, we'll just go back and redo those. I don't think you have to hang around. No problem, we'll let you know.
Marsha Habner of the Nonprofits is available if you need any testimony at any point, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay.
Madam Chair, my apologies. I don't know if an email went out to community members, but I was just grabbed in the hallway and said, hey, we have a committee now. So I think
my fault for not having made. Yes,
okay.
Yes, it was on everyone's schedule. It was on everyone's schedule last week that we were starting at this time or after session. Okay. And my fault for not. I was involved in conversation and didn't make the announcement. I should have.
Well, just maybe why we don't have a quorum, probably.
Andrew, one. Go look at some people. I did talk to Chris about it, too. I don't think we'll have any problems. We'll go back and do formal things like amending bills. We only have the right quorum. And my apologies for not making the announcement. Okay. Representative McGill.
Madam Chair.
Yes. No, we're not going to move the bill. We're just holding them over for inclusion in the omnibus bill, so just start talking. If there are problems for members, if there are members that seem to want amendments or something like that, we may have to act formally on that. But the real formal action on the bill is going to occur Thursday and Friday, so we have plenty of time to fix it up.
All right. Well, okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Today I'm here to speak to House File 1155, which is a self-advocacy bill. Just a synopsis of the bill is that persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities have no consistent statewide funding for self-advocacy or a method of formal communication within the state. Minnesota's funding for disability services is county-based, and the majority of the counties have no funds to support empowerment and self-determination activities for people with developmental and other disabilities. This statewide network that we're looking to create here would assist persons with developmental disabilities and other disabilities to assert their right of self-determination and to increase individual and collective power to live the lives they want to live and deserve. And the network is being called the Self-Advocates Minnesota, or SAM. I do have two testifiers here. If it would be okay with the committee to have them testify?
Yes. Hi.
All right.
You would do that, Rick.
Yes.
Okay, we do need to need your name.
Mrs. Chairperson in the committee, I'm Gloria Steinbring. I am a member of Advocating Change Together. In fact, I'm the founding mother of it. And then 29 years. And this will help us get self-advocacy throughout the state of Minnesota, including my own hometown of Hibbing. I want to see everybody have a chance to have their rights recognized and at their home, workplace. This is really important to me because I want to see self-advocacy grow in the state of Minnesota. It's very important to me. It's my dream.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, members, I'm Rick Cardenas, and I'm the co-director at Advocating Change Together. And the problem that Representative Lador was addressing is, or the problem is something that I would like to address. And by doing that, we put together a number of meetings and brought together over 75 persons with developmental disabilities and other disabilities, plus their allies and supporters, and came up with an idea on how do we get this thing moving, and how do we start this statewide. The resources are not there, and the structure is not there. That's a result of an environmental scan that we provided 2 years ago. So over the past year, we've met over 12 times with this planning group and presented it to a number of organizations throughout the Twin Cities and throughout the state, and gotten their sort of, okay, let's try to do this, let's try to find some funding for this. And as a matter of fact, we have begun two areas of the state. The state is broken down into six areas, northwest, etc., northeast, central, and we were able to get a grant from the DD Council to begin in two areas at the level that we can. So we're working on it, and we're doing it, and hopefully you will include this as part of the bill that comes forward. So thank you.
Madam Chair, basically what we're looking for is the ability to have people we're giving $1 billion a year to people with disabilities in the state of Minnesota, but we're giving them very little voice to say how that money should be spent. So that's what this bill generally is all about. So we appreciate your support.
Are there any questions from members of the committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Medora and testifiers, thank you very much for bringing this forward. It's a dream that we hope that to happen. So thank you very much. I just want to make that comment.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other comments or questions from members? Just one suggestion. We're going to hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. It is likely that the amount of $1 million may be tempered and cut down a little bit. We are working to keep the base. We'll work to keep it in the base, though. But that those two things, depending on how our whole bill gets structured, may have to be dealt with.
We can deal with that. Thank you very, very much, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much for coming. Thank you both. Okay, we have a quorum now, so we can go back, revert to Representative Paulson's bill, which members have heard, and Representative Paulson had an amendment, so that has filed what? House File 376. So the one formal thing we do is that Representative Paulson brought us the A1 amendment, which has been agreed on with the Department of Administration about the fact of just not going back 10 years. So, Representative Sellers moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Mm-hmm. Motion passes. Okay, now as amended, we'll lay House File 376 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay, thanks. Those with you. Representative Lilly.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. House File 1598 is in regards to state workers' contracts. It's ratifying, finishing up the contracts with the state troopers, BCA members, conservation officers, nurses, and who else? I don't know. So I'm going to, if it's all right with the chair, I'd like to pass it to Greg Hubinger.
Yes.
And ask him to go through the bill.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, Subcommittee on Employee Relations. These are the two contracts and plans that were approved on an interim basis by the Subcommittee last fall. All the other labor contracts for state employees for this biennium were ratified by the 2006 legislature. These are the last remaining contracts. The Subcommittee has a tracking sheet that it uses for keeping track of the expenses for these. I don't know if you have that summary in your packets or not. But agencies are required or expected to absorb these costs within their existing budgets.
Okay, so this is one. We may end up doing both. This is one I believe that we do want to pass on to finance. People are so nervous about it, watching what happened with Representative Seifert's bill last whenever it was. It seems like 100 years ago or so. People would really like the contract ratification to not be stuck in whatever else may be happening with the energy session. I certainly have no objection. I guess if someone further up the food chain has an objection to it, we'll know about it. I guess the motion that I'd like for this bill, 1598, is that it be recommended to pass and re-refer to fund. Okay. Representative Ward moves that House File 1598 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. And
thank you very much.
Some of these that we send on we may include in our omnibus bill too, but right now we'll leave that. Okay. Okay. Let's do Representative Thiessen's because I think that's a little easier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is House File 176 that has come out of the Government Operations Committee in a much more narrowed form. It's a study now, but what this is trying to get at, members, is an issue as we transfer more and more to electronic documents, electronic records. There's concerns about kind of how we can continue to access those documents going into the future. And this is both about kind of our internal processes, about what whether we're going to be able to, you know, find our historical records to serve our needs and to serve the needs of the state, and also whether citizens are going to be able to access government records and how easily they're going to be able to access government records going into the future. And so what this study is asking is our Chief Information Officer to study how electronic documents and the processes for reading electronic data can be maintained in a way that that will happen for future generations. Really, that's what it's about. Communicating with citizens communicating with us, and communicating with posterity. I did have an amendment, if we could, Madam Chair. And it's on line 1.9 and 110.
Just a sec. We need to.
I'm sorry.
Should be in the okay.
And one of the amendment, if I could just explain it, and someone can do it on 1.9 after the word choice. Take out the comma and add the word and then add a period after interoperability, and then on 1.10, delete the words vendor neutrality.
So moved. Representative Portman makes that motion.
And
any discussion? You want to tell us why we want to
yes,
do this?
Yes, I would. Well, I can.
Okay.
Briefly, one of the goals of this bill is to make sure that it does not dictate a particular outcome. And we thought by having that language in there, we were not dictating a particular outcome, but in fact, the way that OE, the Office of Enterprise Technology, views these words, it actually may dictate a particular outcome. And so we, it's not that we're not going to be neutral to vendors, but we don't want it to go the other way.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Okay. All those in favor of the Hortman Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. And with that, I think we can lay House File 176 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, members. Madam Chair.
Okay. Is Karen here? Yes. Okay. Ann Peterson? Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair. Yes, we're inserting Senate File 538.
We don't need a motion to keep talking because we're going to hold it over.
Okay, thank you. This bill, 1034 House File or Senate File 538, would direct the state and the department to consider when, must consider when practicable, not practical, geothermal and solar thermal heating and cooling systems, reading from the bill, must be considered when designing, planning, or letting bids for necessary replacement or initial installation of cooling and heating systems in new or existing buildings that are constructed or maintained with state funds. With me is the state architect to lend support.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Heidi Myers. I'm a state architect at the Department of Administration. This bill provides the requirement to look at geothermal applications in the most appropriate time that it can be done in a project, and that's in the process where we can make sure that we have appropriate funds that are recognized for the work, and also that the building is the right type of building for this application to be done.
Okay.
Any questions? Madam Chair,
Representative Fortman.
I had a question. Just since we have the Senate file here, do we want to hold this over for the omnibus bill, or do we want to send it to the general register if there's no money attached to it? I don't know.
Okay, I think. I mean, I think actually we can send this bill out.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
So should I move that we...
So...
First thing we want to do is we want to bring the Senate... We want to bring the Senate file before us, and we want to lay the... So...
Mr. Shepard is...
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
So...
We made more amendments.
Shepard,
maybe Representative Peterson can help us with how the language differs from the House file and the Senate
file. Well, we're going to put the language of the House file. If there's a difference, we're putting the language of the House file.
Yes, sir. Madam Chair, and I was just consulting with Representative Peterson to find out if he wanted to reinsert the language of House File 1034, the first engrossment, into the Senate bill, and then I believe that that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so I'll move that House File 1034 be recommended to pass, recommended to pass, it goes to the Finance Committee. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I move that Senate File 538 be recommended to pass and go to the Senate file and go to Finance. Now I'll move that the language in Senate File 538 be deleted and replaced with the language of the House file, and the House file be laid on the table.
Thank you.
I think that's all right. Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair, and just if I could clarify with Representative Peterson, the most recent engrossment of the House file we have is the first committee engrossment dated March 5th of 07.
Correct.
And that, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that. Correct.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
And okay. So the motion before us is to now move Senate File 538 with the language in the, of the House file to the full Finance Committee. Any further discussion of that?
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Peterson can tell us how, what the language is there. I'm a little uncomfortable.
Okay.
I don't trust the Senate anyway, but...
Madam Chair and Representative Zellers, I believe we put in solar thermal heating on the House side too, which I ran by the department, state architect in the task committee, and it was accepted, geothermal and solar thermal. And I believe we changed practical to practicable, whatever it is. Trying to get it right. Change those couple things.
Representative Peterson, can you say that five times real fast?
Madam Chair, Representative Horgan, no.
Good. Okay. All those in favor of that?
I apologize. I'm just reading real fast. So it says when. If it isn't practical.
No, we don't have the language. I'm sorry. We don't have the language of the House file in front of us. Sorry about that.
And
the. So you tell us exactly. Go get that. Okay. What are the?
And I guess while we wait for the language to be copied back to us, what are the when?
That's what we did.
You know, what if it suits the cause? Okay. What if it doesn't? Is there any penalties? Or are there any requirements? Any? Someone looks at it and says, solar panels don't fit on this roof or don't work in this shaded area, or then penalties or.
Madam Chair, drivers, no, it's in the pre-design, so that would be determined, and if it doesn't fit, doesn't work, there won't be any penalty for not doing it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
It's on here.
Okay. I don't think there'll be any problem, but I don't want to. Oh, it's coming. Oh, okay. Here it is. Okay, this is the language that's going into the bill. Anybody have any? Okay, and the motion before us now is that the language in the Senate file be replaced by the language that's in the House file. Any discussion? Any further questions?
Okay.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, now the next motion. We'll also move that the bill be passed, that Senate file 538 be passed and referred to finance. Pass on. Okay, that's it.
That's correct. Madam Chair, that's correct.
And you are testifying in favor of the bill?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Madam Chair, ma'am, why do you need to vote?
Madam Chair, and Representative Swigand.
You've got to state your name again for the committee members, too.
My name is Heidi Myers. I'm the state architect. I'm with the Department of Administration. In the pre-design process, we look at alternative energy sources, and this is one of the more important alternative energy sources, so that it puts a more emphasis on looking at that.
So why would you look at it now, you do it now, you would consider geothermal now?
Myers, Madam Chair, this bill would help agencies and local units of government that receive state funding to look at the alternative energy sources, all alternative energy sources, in particular the geothermal. And it's a bill that does not come from admin.
The answer is that they can do it. It gives them more specific directions to do it. And they're not unhappy with it.
Okay.
Representative Fellows.
To my last question, Representative Peterson, you assured me that there were no penalties in there. Can you assure me that going forward, there will not be penalties? We won't amend this in a year or two to include the penalties if they don't?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't plan to do that. We're just setting up a, you know, pre-design review must include. So it's not my intent to do that, I guess, but, you know, the members could do it if they wanted to.
Even as one of the most extreme government control everything people, I would have no intent of doing this either. I'd be real cautious about what we wanted to require in state law in architectural, even me.
Well, and I appreciate that, Madam Chair. It's just always good to have that on tape someplace.
Okay. Okay. So the motion is now that... okay. So it's now moved that Senate File 538, as amended, go on to finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. House File 768 is a bill relating to absentee voting, and the goal of House File 768 is to save money for local units of government that administer our elections, to maintain the security of our voting, and also deal with a couple of issues for the disability community when it comes to absentee voting as well. And available to testify if needed are a representative of the Secretary of State's office, a representative, and two representatives of the Voting Rights Coalition, or at least one I know for sure is here, and I believe that one other may be here. The bill was heard pretty thoroughly in government operations, and the main fiscal impact, as you'll see in the fiscal note, is related to the statewide voter registration system, and the total cost to the Secretary of State's office to absorb the changes will be $123,000. A couple of quick points. Basically, the eligibility for absentee voting will now be, in essence, no excuse absentee voting, which is largely the standard across the state, but this just clarifies it and makes sure that that's the standard, and also makes the process a little bit more efficient in terms of the absentee voting. And also, the absentee section 3 really deals with the ongoing absentee status and that are related to the no excuse needed, some kind of technical cleanup there to align with that. Section 4 relates to the delivery of ballots, and currently the main thrust of Section 4 is are those who face a challenge in getting to the polls or to even get their absentee ballot application in because of health reasons or disability. And the one thing I'd like to point out is that currently there are elections officials who do go to nursing homes and actually facilitate voting currently, and so a lot of what we're proposing is really not that substantively different from what we have here. It merely makes things line up with facilitating the process more efficiently. And the last section 6, the agent delivery of ballots, we extend the time from 4 days to 7 days for agent delivery, again, to make sure the window is open enough so that we're franchising those who may be disenfranchised because of health reasons or disability. And I just want to read about, on page 5, line 5, An agent may deliver ballots to no more than three persons in any election, and that was one of the things that we discussed in government operations. Just clarifying that the security measures that we have today will continue to stay rigid and keep our system secure. So I believe that runs through the bill adequately, Madam Chair, and I stand for questions, and there are those who are available here if needed.
Representative Pepper.
Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, to me this changing of the requirement would just be laden with fraud, keep it on an ongoing basis. If there's absolutely no, I'm looking at the bill summary here, if there's no, if you're not required to vote in the presence of a witness, we're going to remove all those requirements in the absentee ballots. How do we know fraud isn't being committed? I mean, to me, this is a huge change, and it just is, to me, it's unbelievable that you bring this bill forward. There's a reason that these standards have been in place, and I guess my question to you would be, if I can vote by absentee ballot, basically for any reason, without having a witness there, why would I even need to go to the polls? What would be the point? How are we going to regulate this so there's not fraud? And I guess I would like the department or the Secretary of State to perhaps address that too.
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, that's a perfect lead-in to Ms. Fraser, Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office, who can comment a little bit about the security measures in the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Fraser. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office. Currently, the witness for absentee ballots plays basically a procedural role. All that they are witnessing is that the ballot was blank when the person got it. That's pretty much what the role that they play. And what we've heard is that Minnesota residents who are out of state often have trouble finding someone who is eligible to witness the ballot, because right now it's limited to people who are registered to vote in Minnesota or can otherwise give an oath or a notary. And so we've heard stories about people who either couldn't find people to witness the ballots and were therefore weren't able to send in their ballots, or running around town trying to find a notary at the last minute.
And I'm sharing, Ms. Fraser, if that's the case, why would we want to just open this up everywhere across the state for any reason? Why wouldn't we just have an exception for those people who are out of state or some type of exception like that? Because to me, if you don't, you're saying it's only there so that we know that the correct, or so that you're witnessing it. Well, if you don't have that protection in place at all, how do you even know that the right person is filling out the ballot? If there's no, how do you know that my ex-husband isn't there grabbing my ballot? How could you possibly know? Or if I had a child or student in college, how would you know that I wasn't voting for that person?
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, we would know the same way that we know right now, which is we do a signature match on every absentee ballot. We look at your application and we look at the ballot, and if there's any question about whether the signature matches, or if there's any question, if it looks like the signature does not match, then your ballot is not counted.
I still have a lot of questions. I don't think this is a good bill, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, I think the issue is basically that the witness doesn't really do anything. The witness doesn't watch the person.
The witness puts his name on the line and watches it.
No, yeah, but all they're just saying is that it was an empty ballot. They're not saying that the person signed it. They're not saying that the person that they handed it to filled it out or anything like that. Any of the things that you might think it would, as I understand it. But all the witness is saying is that this was an empty ballot.
But the witness has to sign on the outside of that. I've done this before myself. The witness has to sign on the outside of the ballot, correct, Ms. Fraser? To say that the ballot is in there?
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, the witness does have to sign that the ballot was blanked, that the ballot was blank when it was received, and that the individual filled out the ballot.
Right, correct. Okay.
Madam Chair,
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask Representative Pepin a question. In the absence of this procedure, Representative Pepin, what would you think could happen that wouldn't otherwise?
Well, with all due respect, Madam Chair and Representative Hilty, I think people, if people want to take advantage of the right to vote, they should go to the polls and vote. I mean, if we're going to go this way, why do we even have polls? Why not just have everybody voting from home, and let's not have any controls on who votes? Let's just let anybody, let's vouch for it. You know, we don't even have vouchers on this anymore. Let's just let anybody at any time vote for whatever reason. How do we even, I just think that this just opens the door for allowing anybody to vote, including illegal aliens who currently can't vote, Madam Chair. I just think it really opens this up, and I think that there would just be so much fraud potential in this, but I've had my piece, so I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Madam Chair, if I could address the need real quickly. There are transportation workers who are long-haul truckers and railroad workers who are almost always away from the polls on election day. We have families who are spending more and more time on the road, and certainly in my district, 70% of my community, of my workforce commutes 42, 44, 45, 50, 60 miles, and given our transportation system, one could very easily leave home at 6:30 and not return until 8:15 or 8:30. And the standard currently is someone who reasonably believes that you would be absent from the polls, which is open for interpretation. We have many voters who may be disenfranchised by the current standard, who are citizens, who have a legal right to vote, and for whom we should be doing everything we can to ensure that the constitutional franchise of voting is extended to everyone eligible under the Constitution. Lastly, when it comes to security issues, in 2004, 2,828,000 ballots were cast in Minnesota, and there were 14 alleged cases of people voting who were not eligible. So you do the math, that's a confidence rate of 99.9995%. I can tell you that anyone working in data security would love to have a confidence rate of 99.9995%.
To this point, Madam Chair?
Representative Pepin, but I don't understand what's the problem with an unregistered voter. You still need to prove, well, just...
Representative Kalin's point about not being able to get there or whatnot, could you just clarify the law for me on what is the requirement of employers on voting day for being able to vote? It seems to me that there's some statutory provision that would require employers to allow reasonable time for employees to vote by statute. Am I incorrect on that?
Madam Chair?
Thank you.
The statute, or the current status of that provision, I'll ask Ms. Fraser to comment in more detail, but I do know that there are employers who do not extend paid time off to do so, and I think our families are being squeezed so much that to ensure that we can extend the constitutional franchise of voting, we need to do everything we can to make sure that we do so. And I'll ask Ms. Fraser just to comment maybe in a little more detail.
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, the statute does currently require employers to give employees time off to vote without deduction in pay on the morning of election day. I think that there are some employers that put quite a few restrictions in place. You know, you have to ask a certain amount ahead of time, and that in effect you may not be able to get the time off, but statute does currently require it. There's also no penalty for not allowing your employees time off, and so when there have been cases of employers not allowing their employees time off, it's been unclear what the remedy was.
Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kalin, I wouldn't, don't mean to be crass, but I think this is the couch potatoes Bill of Rights or Right to Vote Act. This puts in to law, you can be lazy inadequate, unmotivated, whatever, and you can still vote. And the right to vote, I think, is one of our first and most important rights. But that was standing to your to the witness thing. If I'm in the room and I tell my little girl she can only have one cookie or one bar, she'll have one. If I'm not in the room, she might have two or three. So whether or not the person is actually verifying that, yes, you did vote and you're the right person, if you have a witness in the room, for Representative Pepin's point, is you're going to have a level there of honesty, and especially if it's someone whose either name isn't on there. And it, I agree, again, if we're going to do this, why don't we just have the provision for out-of-state? Employers right now, I think in Minnesota, if we're talking about confidence level rates, how many employees were actually came forward and said, my employer failed to let me vote today, or fined me, or you know, fired me because I asked to go and vote today. I think that would be another high confidence level thing. But the part that is most egregious to me is the, you know, taking away any kind of reason. And if you're going to be out of town, I voted absentee in the past. If I'm going to be out of town, if you had a week, 2 weeks, you can have the application sent to you. This is, to me, this is watering down one of our most basic rights. And Madam Chair, if there were ever veto bait, you know, trolling in the water, I would say this would be one of the biggest. I'd suggest you keep this out of your bill so that we can at least have something going forward, because I think this would be, if there ever was, this would be one of the smelliest chums in the water.
Wait for the governor's veto. Representative,
yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zellers, to address some of your remarks, actually I carried this bill or a version of it a couple years ago, and I can tell you who I heard from about this was over-the-road truckers who never know until the last minute where they're going to be, and sometimes spend every weekend except one away from their home and out of state. Same thing applies to railroad workers. The same thing applies to people that work in the airlines that are any part of a flight crew. The same thing applies to any number of business executives who fly out of Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport on Monday morning and are lucky if they return on Friday afternoon. And they don't always know weeks in advance when that's going to occur. Sometimes they only know hours in advance. And that this is an effort to accommodate those people, and I think it's a reasonable effort to do so. And moreover, as far as the couch potato thing goes, I think you should be aware that all across this state right now, there are many, many precincts that vote mail-in entirely, as well as does the entire state of Oregon.
And Madam Chair, to that point, and we're not Oregon, I'm thankful of it. Representative Hilty, I've, like I said, I've voted absentee before. And if there's in the law right now, it doesn't say you have to have a plane ticket to leave the state, or you have to have an assignment for your over-the-road load to be in Washington or Texas. But if there's reasonable potential for that, if you think that maybe you're going to be out of town, and I was one of those people that would go in the morning, and yes, by middle afternoon, they'd say you're going on a plane today to, you know, Arkansas or Mississippi. When it got to the first part of September, of October, I would, if I thought that there was any time coming up in the next month and a half that I was going to be gone, I applied for a ballot. It's that simple. It's in law right now. And those folks who want to vote will do that. Either they'll make arrangements with an absentee ballot, or if they are going to be in town, they'll go and vote. I just don't like the fact that I agree with Representative Pepin. This is wide open for fraud and abuse in the system. And I think we've hashed this over enough, Madam Chair, but this to me is what I would consider bad legislation going forward, when we've already got all those provisions in law. You can vote absentee in law. This just is just saying that it doesn't matter who you are or where you are. If it gets sent to the wrong address, if it gets sent to the wrong family member.
Remember, Representative Sellers, there's no removal of the requirement to sign the ballot and to have it match up with the registered person.
You're right. I apologize, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative Portman. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll just point out that the signature match for absentee balloting is something that doesn't exist when you're in person, and so that's absentee balloting is actually more secure. Absentee voting is more secure than in-person voting. And I know that we'll have a conversation later about Uncle Tim Carlson denying his nephew John Carlson, who's known all his life, from voting at 7:45 in the evening for getting his license when his aunt drove him to the polls. But I guess, Representative Zellers, I don't think that it's our position of this legislature to decide who deserves, based on merit or work, what their constitutional franchise of voting should be, with that a couch potato isn't, that someone that you call a couch potato isn't worthy of voting, or someone that's an on-the-road, over-the-road trucker, or I had a constituent have to leave on Monday afternoon, drive 7 hours to say goodbye to his mom. He drove 7 hours back to get to the polls at 7:30 on election day. If he had been able to have agent delivery, or I think it's the agent delivery actually, that he would have difficulty getting to the polls.
Perhaps this bill would solve that problem.
But in general, we have all sorts of situations where individuals are not given the opportunity to exercise their constitutional franchise. I, frankly, want to remove every barrier to those who are ready to vote, eligible to vote, with the secure system of the signature match, and we just have a philosophical difference here. But I think it's a very good bill that will actually extend that franchise and make Minnesota an even more of a leader in voter turnout and voter participation.
Okay. Any other comments on the bill? Okay. Representative Ward?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'll move that we lay over House File 768 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Say this, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Okay. Thank you.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
So we probably don't have to vote to lay over, but I appreciate
what?
The vote. I'm sorry. We probably don't have to vote to lay over, but I appreciate the vote.
I know. I just thought you looked.
This is a good one.
I just said it without. Oh, you sounded like you were anxious to have a vote.
That's true. It felt good. That's a.
Yeah, I know. I could. It just seemed like you wanted one. Yes, okay. Representative Rowley. Representative Rowley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Now that everybody's all awake and wound up, I'll get them a little going a little more, hopefully. Excuse me. House File 333 is a bill requiring a full compensation for the first government shutdown in Minnesota's history. As a result of what happened in 2005, there was about 8,300 employees that were forced to use vacation or comp time. After that, the governor and his team and the unions got together and brokered a deal that essentially would give the workers half of the pay, and part of the deal also was that they couldn't really lobby for it. I saw the problem that was essentially going on, and I'm here by myself. I've had constituents that have talked to me, but so essentially they were offered half the pay or nothing. Just so you know, in the federal government, not that we want to follow what the federal government does, but if they ever have a shutdown, they pay the employees fully. The whole situation was really not the fault of the state workers. We have great state workers, I feel, and it was what was going on up here in the legislature and the governor, and it was kind of the brokering that was going on back and forth between the two bodies, three bodies, with the Senate and the House and the governor. So I don't really want to argue about why or how or what, but we did get to the government shutdown for one reason or another. So this bill is about treating people fairly. It's about treating, which I think is a valued employees for the state, in a right way. Last session, I offered an amendment on the floor to a state government finance bill, a bill that perhaps you'll be putting together. And with a little help from Marty Seifert, he offered an amendment. It passed in the end, 114 to 19, and then later died when the bill was tabled, as we all remember. So I submitted this House file again. I'm trying to treat the employees fair. To me, it's not big money. Just please keep in mind that we did fully fund these departments 100%. So it's just kind of, to me, it's the principle of it, and I think we should separate what we do up here to what the employees are doing. We hire them in good faith, and we should treat them fairly. I don't know if you remember, too, we also had an aside light. We got into all that argument of essential versus non-essential, and I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to be told that I'm non-essential or any of that. But that has nothing to do with this bill. That's just a love editorial comment. Just what you need today.
Most of the time, you want to be told that you're non-essential. So if you're essential, you don't have the right to strike. So
in this, right.
Okay.
So that's basically the bill. I do have some opposition. The folks from Dewar are going to come up. So be nice to Mr. Larson. He's a constituent of mine. And so I've received notes from Mr. Larson and his wife that they're very much against this. But other than that, people are pretty much for this. And I think he's... So please be nice to him. I don't think I'll get a sign location.
Madam Chair, thanks. I had a question for Representative Lilly. Could you refresh my memory, Representative Lilly, this agreement you had referred to? And wasn't this agreed through the collective bargaining process and the executive branch and the unions came to some sort of settlement on this and all the parties signed off on it and you thought this issue had been disposed of, or am I thinking about it incorrectly? Is my recollection faulty?
Chairman Kahn and Representative Forrest, you're right, but it was a broker deal. I have a copy of the contract. I can pass out to you. Part of the deal was between, I have the one with me from AFSCME essentially and MAKE, and so Arsenal will speak to some of that, of course. But, you know, we're legislators. We're a different body. The body, to me, it's the principle about treating people right. It's not... yes, it was a signed deal, but they were essentially offered, and I don't know how, I wasn't at the table, but they were offered half a cow. So you either take half a cow or nothing, and what is your choice? So in my mind, yes, there was a signed contract, and I can give you a copy of it and look at it. And part of the deal is, you know, that in a way it's not fair, too, because, you know, Mr. Larson can testify against my bill, or to lobby essentially against an effort that I'm making, but MAPE or AFSCME or any other of the workers that were affected by this agreement, they can't say squat. So, you know, I mean, that's why people aren't knocking on your doors. It's kind of way against, you know, the others. But yes, there was a signed contract. I'm sorry, I didn't answer yes or no.
No, that's, Madam Chair and Representative, that's fine. But what's coming here is there certainly is an alternative. I mean, the grievance process benefits both parties. I mean, certainly the union, if they thought it was an unjust settlement, I believe could have grieved it and gone to an arbitrator to make their case, but they chose to settle, which a lot of things happen. I mean, that's not unusual. But, boy, are we starting to tread some dangerous ground here when the legislature starts micromanaging and getting involved in grievance settlements and potentially overriding them or not. I can understand perhaps why the unions aren't up there. I mean, this could certainly end up being a double-edged sword to start having, by legislative fiat, overrides. I mean, we set up, we have a Bureau of Mediation Services, we have Chapter 1, so we've established an entire statutory scheme that we started about 1973, Representative, or 71, if I'm not mistaken. And we got a whole process set up specifically to deal with these things so the legislature doesn't get involved in it, to depoliticize some of these grievances. And I just said, folks, and I don't know what's going to be in your bill, Madam Chair, but we are really starting to tread dangerous ground here, colleagues, we're going to have the legislature start micromanaging and get involved in grievance settlements, because the grievance settlement that gets overridden that you write one day might be, the shoe might be on the other foot the next day. So that's my 2 cents. I think we got a great statutory scheme in place here to take care of these things. That would, as a member of the Subcommittee of Employee Relations, that would be my advice to all of us collectively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Employee Relations. And in that capacity, I also serve as a state labor negotiator. I'm before you today testifying. I have about 30 years in the area of labor relations with the state of Minnesota. And obviously, you heard the testimony from Representative Lilly. We do not support this legislation, but not in any sense of trying to be mean-spirited. And I'll try to keep my testimony brief, but when the budget session for the current biennium that we're in, the 0305 budget session, when it appeared that there was not going to be a resolution, I met with Commissioner Ludeman and explained to him that we had a problem. We were on a collision course, and we had to address what would happen in the event the legislature did not reach a budget resolution. The problem being, first of all, and that is that the state of Minnesota Constitution says that the state cannot spend any money unless there's an appropriation, which we didn't have. And then Chapter 16B of Minnesota statute says that we can't pay an employee for not working. They have to be working in order to be paid. We sat down with the unions and explained the dilemma that we were facing. And in the area of labor relations, paying people for not working is a real sore spot. There are some people that deeply resent, especially if they had to work and they see someone that isn't working get paid. We just dealt with that, and we continually deal with it on weather emergencies. When people have to come to work, and we have people that get to stay home and get paid and so on. And it just, it hosted a variety of issues for us. We called a meeting with the unions, all of them, and we sat down, we explained the dilemma that we were facing, and they understood the Constitution, and they understood the laws that we were facing. So we worked on an agreement with the unions. And the agreement being is that in the event that legislature does not reach a resolution on the budget and employees were indeed, we tried to avoid the word furloughed, but indeed not working, we provided an option which these employees would be able to, by their own choice, use vacation leave, and that we would pay them that vacation leave once the legislature provided the funding for the state agencies. And, of course, and it was signed by everybody. We had a plan in place. And then the shutdown occurred. And we applied the spirit of this memorandum of understanding during the course of the shutdown. Now, once we got back to the bargaining table with the unions, they wanted to be paid in spite of the fact that we had this memorandum of understanding. I said a deal is a deal, but we sat down with them and we continued to discuss this in bargaining. And what we agreed was, let's continue to talk about it. We settled our contracts and we said, we'll continue to meet with you and we will have a process in place that has no dispute resolution process beyond the actual just mediation of this process. We had 5 meetings with the unions over this matter. We brought in a mediator from the Bureau of Mediation Services to help us with that. And again, we had the principles of paying people for not working. We also had employees that, for a variety of instances, would not have worked anyway. We had pre-approved vacation. We had sick leave. It created a host of problems for us. And then not alone that, we had about 15 grievances that had been filed during the course of the shutdown. It was during the discussion that an agreement was reached. In fact, a couple of points that I would like to share with Representative Lilly, and that was the union proposed, well, let's do half. The union proposed, let's do half of it. We met with the governor, and we said, you know, this might resolve everything. What if we agree, if we give the employees half? And this boiled down to about 20 hours of restored pay. It came to about $4 million, and that's how we costed it out. And the understanding was it was done. And it wasn't that the unions were barred from this, because we had a deal in place. And it says the unions won't lobby beyond what we have in this settlement that we have. It says that neither party will add to, diminish, or enhance the terms of this agreement. And we're living up to that. Now, I'm not accusing the unions of not doing that, but I can assure you if the legislature was voting today to take away the hours that had been restored to them, I would expect them to be here. We have a deal, and we had it in place. After the agreement was reached, we brought this memorandum of understanding in front of the Subcommittee of Employee Relations, although they didn't have to approve it. But what they did have to approve was for the managers and the managerial plan employees and the commissioner plan employees, which we had about 300 employees, for this as well. And so the point that I want to emphasize on this is that this is over, we're going on 3 years. We're looking at a cost of about $2.8 million in money. We have a host of administrative problems. We have employees that have had pay increases during that period of time. We've had employees who have retired. We've had employees who have had their vacation accruals put into the Minnesota State Retirement System health care account. It would be a huge administrative nightmare. And in closing, Madam Chair, you know, if had I done over again, we would never have walked through this, and the legislature could have dealt with this back then. But to deal with this now, 3 years later, with the principles that we had when we reached an agreement with the union and the cost associated, as well as the administrative huge administrative problems that we have with it, we cannot support this bill.
Representative Portman.
But just briefly, my understanding is that the motion is to lay it over for possible inclusion,
yes,
in the omnibus state government finance,
yes,
bill. And I think both of the gentlemen before us today have really made good points. I can certainly understand Representative Lilly's motivation, because as a state representative, I remember feeling pretty horrible about the whole impact on employees of the shutdown. You know, as freshmen, there seemed to be little we could do to prevent that. But and when we heard that half had been restored, and not knowing all the details that you provided in the context, it just seemed like, boy, that's not fair, half. So I really appreciate that you took the time to come today, and I certainly understand the motivation that Representative Lilly brings also.
One of the things that I had suggested, because I understand, and we're really, government operations has already decided that this should pass. We're really concerned about the financial aspects of it and what it's going to cost. One thing I was really sympathetic to was the administrative difficulty of dealing with things after the fact. And so, but you've already dealt with it once, because you did do it. And one of the suggestions that I made, and I know we can get we don't have language here today to do it at the time, but it was, is that just take only the employees who are here now, so that we're not going giving money to retired people and so forth, and just give them exactly what they gave before. So it's you don't have to redo the entire calculation. So it'll be a little bit less, because some people will have retired or gone away or something like that. And so what I'm interested in, would that be a much simpler way of doing it?
Madam Chair, it would still, you know, just replicate,
yes,
what we did back then,
yes,
but only for the current
employees. Only for
employees,
the current employees.
Without checking with the Department of Finance and with the agencies, it seems easier than the way the bill is currently written. I think it's important to note, Madam Chair, if I may say, that the agencies were, while they did receive funding for that biennium, it was flat funded. Those settlements that we settled with the state employee contracts was $200 million in new money, and there was no appropriation for that money. So, you know, there's this misnomer out there that the agencies have this money to do that. And we funded those salary increases out of the hides and the lack of services that we provide to that. And so this is new money.
Mr. Larson, if this is going into the bill, there will be new money. If we're going to put it into the bill, if, as we do our fine, we would put new money in. We would not just have to eat the cost of it. But the other thing that I would do is that the intention would be to write an amendment that would just double it for the employees that are still here, to not get into what I think is a legitimate nightmare of how hard it would be to do that.
Madam
Okay.
And members, I just want to, Mr. Larson is right, certainly, about the problems that would be related, and I'm very open to Chair Kahn's suggestions. I work for Northwest Airlines, and we're kind of going through this right now. I'm a machinist, and we had had a deal with where we sold some of our debt service, essentially, or whatever, but they sold off 20%, and so as employees, we were able to get that back. Now they just, Northwest agreed that we could sell off another 20% of that money. And so I would imagine to go through it again would be much easier. And I'm certainly sympathetic, and it's definitely nothing personal about Mr. Larson and his work. I just think it's the right thing in treating people right. That, it doesn't really get to some of your questions. But
one of the things that is the remembrance that we did pass this on the House. We did pass full payback on the House floor. So we did have a vote of the House on this issue. And so I imagine some members here probably voted for it. What did you say the vote was, Representative Lilly?
It was, Madam Chair and members, it was 114-19, and I don't want to name names, but a very high, powerful one was voted with me, but maybe he knew the bill would table.
Representative Forrest.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And a question for Mr. Larson. Could not this subject also be worked upon at the bargaining table between the executive and the unions?
Madam Chair, Representative Forrest, it is, anytime you're looking at compensation, that is a term and condition of employment for which the parties could obviously negotiate over.
Madam Chair, my only thought is that these are incredibly complex contracts. We've got, 35,000 state employees roughly out there with all different employment situations. During the shutdown, they may have been on some type of unpaid leave. Who knows? I just get a little bit concerned in bargaining if you brought this subject up. Of course, the outcome is uncertain, but at least you would have all the interested parties at the table to work on it. And I just worry that if we do something again by legislative fiat, we may be creating all sorts of administrative nightmares, et cetera. I personally think that this is a term and condition of employment that the parties should bargain for at the table, precisely because they bring the expertise and experience to the table to work out a workable agreement.
I don't have much help. I'm kind of, from the labor rules. I really don't know the nature of the negotiations, if they're how they're, historically how they went. I'm a fairly new member. I'm just starting my second term, and maybe some more senior members like yourself and Chair Kahn have a sense of that, but. I think it's, again, a pretty easy fix. Yes, there's going to be some casualties. There'll be some people that have quit. That'll
won't get money, and
they'll probably grumble, but that's too bad. It's just a simple answer for that.
The problem of snarling up a bargaining process doesn't really appeal to me. And one of the things that bothers me about it was the requirement, the signing off on the agreement not to lobby or ask for this. I don't even know if that carries through into the bargaining process.
Well, Madam Chair, the bargaining process is months long. I think that the parties could work this out. But, I think the problem is that, as Representative Lilly said, there will be some grumbling, and those who are left out and perceive that they're not being treated fairly by this process will probably file a grievance, as is their right. And so I have a concern here, considering how many employees were involved with this, that perhaps it's a bit pessimistic on my part. I'm just not convinced that we can craft legislation that is going to meet every situation. Perhaps we can. But again, that's why we have the bargaining process, to bring the folks who know the agreements and know the history and have the expertise to the table to talk about it.
Madam Chair and members, I think sometimes... as elected officials, we need to do what I would call the right thing. I mean, we need to step up and be the parents in the room. We need to, that's what it's about. I'm certainly open to them renegotiating. I don't know how that works, honestly. I just think, you know, nobody really wants to talk about this because it's a little embarrassing. It's embarrassing for all of us in this room that were members at the time. It's embarrassing for the governor because, you know, he's governor. We're all members during the first shutdown. I mean, I find it a little embarrassing. You know, it's not, you know, when we went door knocking and, you know, I think it affected some of the results this fall. And I try not to make it partisan and all that stuff, but I've really tried hard. I tried on the floor, and I'm trying again today. I just think it's the right thing.
Well, I guess I'd like to lay this over for possible inclusion with the omnibus bill, with the understanding that I'm sure there'll be an amendment on. And I'm going to ask to have the language drafted to, as I suggested, that it would just pay the existing employees what they were paid by the last time. Representative Singer.
Chair, just a quick word of advice. Don't put it in your bill. Respect the process, the MOU, the negotiations took place with Dora and Mr. Larson and the unions. But if you do put it in your bill for justice and the right thing to do, pay time and a half to those folks who work. If you're going to pay everybody for not working, pay time and a half to those folks who work. Then you have another unjust situation.
Well, you know, again, I thought...
Hey, double already, time. Okay. Pay triple time.
Okay. No more discussion. We'll lay this over for possible understanding that this is not fair.
Thank you, Chair and members.
Madam Chair,
while we're waiting for a nice witness to come up, I got a copy from Representative Magnus of the, I think this is the Energy Finance Bill, and I just had a question about one section, and I can give you a copy of this, but included in the Energy Finance Bill is the license technology fees. We spent any number of days talking about OET and, you know, how these things are going to be financed, the technology, upgrading, any number of things. And by the look on your face, I don't think it's something that anybody warned you about or gave you a heads up on. But just as an FYI, the folks over at Energy are going to, maybe you can either exclude it out of your bill or... they're taking stealing part of your action, I guess, is what I'd say, because they've got the whole section here on licensing and the fees and where it goes and who gets it and everything. I'm just curious as to why.
In fact, it's in the Energy Finance Bill.
Yeah.
Discuss it when Representative Hilty's in the room.
Okay.
See, clearly, no matter what happens, we're not going to fund things twice in two different bills, even if the language exists in two different bills.
Just trying to lay claim for our committee, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Simon.
Guess which one this one is.
Which one are you going to start with?
House File 1546, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1546 is the automatic voting registration bill. It was thoroughly vetted and discussed in Representative Filowski's committee, so I understand we're just here to talk about the money, in essence. But you probably want a little bit of an idea about what this thing is, so I'll just say a few words and then turn it over to Secretary of State Mark Ritchie. In essence, this just reverses the presumption we have right now. Right now, when you go in to fill out an application for a driver's license or a reapplication, as the case may be, there's a box you can check if you want to be registered to vote. It's an opt-in. This would just make it an opt-out. That's basically the bill. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, and that's why there is a fiscal note, but in essence, that's what it is. It's an opt-out rather than opt-in when you go to get your driver's license. And, of course, there are some upfront costs. If you have the fiscal note in front of you, virtually all the costs are up front. The total general fund cost of this, according to the finance, combining all the agencies involved, Secretary of State and Public Safety, would be $768,000 the first year, $246,000 the second year, and then $15,000 in the two subsequent years. That's because it's mostly upfront sunk costs in terms of software and so forth. But to describe it a little bit more, why don't I, and the way, by the way, that is being proposed to pay for this, which is through HABA money, the Help America Vote Act money. Let me turn it over to the Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie.
Mr. Ritchie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This idea and the background for this actually came to our office from the local election officials, both at the county level and city clerks, who pointed out that thanks to the great success and the great interest of Minnesota citizens in registering and voting and participating, we were having a tremendous number of new voter registrations, and folks were standing in line, and we were duplicating many efforts in our state's voter registration system, and that there were some procedures we could adopt that would help us save money at the local level, both before Election Day, on Election Day, and in the follow-up to elections with our post-election data entry. This idea has two parts to address two of the big areas where there's a lot of duplication going on right now. One of them is the use of U.S. Postal Service change of address system. You go in, you change your address. They have a procedure by which they can supply us with that information. We would take that information and use that information to update people's voter registration records and to send them a follow-up postcard to say, we've noted you've moved, we've updated your record, please let us know if that's not your intention to change your address for the purposes of voter registration. And the second part is to take those individuals, as Representative Simon mentioned, who would be applying for driver's licenses, an ID, state ID, or their learner's permit, and again, people would come to us through the Department of Public Safety. They would have done the work of both identifying the age and the citizenship status. We would work with the judiciary, with the Supreme Court Administration to determine people's eligibility in terms of felon status and guardianship, and if someone was in fact had met all four conditions of being able to vote in this state, then they would be notified that they were being registered, who was their name, their address, all that information, and they would have another opportunity to opt out of the system. So they would have two opportunities in the beginning and at the time of the postcard. The savings estimated by the counties and local units of government is about $1 million each election cycle. First, that's reducing the cost of entering names in normal voter registration. Second, reducing the cost of election judges and poll workers on Election Day, because this would greatly reduce the number of people who are registering on Election Day. And then finally, it would reduce the cost of post-election data entry of those of us who do register on Election Day, which in a good year, an election year for president, is approaching nearly 600,000. So that kind of savings is quite significant at the local level. The fiscal note, as you see it, much of this can be covered from the HABA money, but there's some ongoing cost with maintaining our relationship with U.S. Postal Service and their vendors, and maintaining our relationships with Department of Public Safety and with the judiciary to make sure we're getting this information. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Any questions of either Mr. Simon or... Okay. No questions, and we'll hold this over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
1547, Representative Simon.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Many of you were in the room when I was here last week pitching a similar bill, and that bill was to end the practice currently in law by which we back out from the money that we give to political candidates in this state, that is the state campaign fund, public campaign fund. We back out of that the amount of money that the Office of Administrative Hearings needs to enforce complaints that arise under the law. And so I was here telling you then that, you know, I certainly understood with all the tough decisions that you have to make in this committee that making it easier for politicians to get money isn't necessarily at the top of your list, and I understand that. Well, this one is even more so the case, because this this bill would be a straight-up appropriations increase in the amount in the fund. The last bill would end the sort of back-out process. This would up the amount in the fund from $1.25 million per election cycle to the $2 million that it once was as recently as the 2002 election. So this would restore the funds that were whittled away over the years. And again, the same disclaimer applies. I understand you have tough decisions to make. I don't want to sound like I'm dissing my own bill, like I said before. And I completely understand that, you know, giving more money to that fund may not be appetizing for some folks, but I think there's some merit to it. It was once at $2 million. I think putting it back to that amount, especially considering that at least presently, unless and until my other bill is enacted, we back out about $120,000, $130,000 a year from that amount anyway, so it's not really $2 million. It's more like, or not really, yeah, $2 million. It's more like, well, that's subtracting the OAH expenses. So that's the pitch for the bill. I understand that there are merits and demerits, but that's the idea before you, is to up that amount to what it once was from $1.25 million to $2 million.
Okay. Representative Courtney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, I just want to undist your bill again, because I think that when voters in this state learn about how this system works, they have more faith in the candidates, because they know that they're not funded by special interests. We have a problem with the total mistrust of the caucuses because of the proportion of the dollars that are contributed by special interests. And so I think any bill that puts money in the publicly funded campaign finance system shouldn't be referred to as more money for politicians to run their campaigns. I think it's more money for public servants to run publicly funded campaigns, so that big dollar special interest contributors have less say on the process. And I think it works very well at the candidate level. It doesn't work at all, of course, at the party level. But so just to undist your bill and say, I think it's absolutely legitimate that we keep trust in our democracy, and I think this is part of it. And when you look at $2 million in the context of the trust of the voters and the people who represent them, it is an expenditure that's very well worth making.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Portman. Yes, I mean, I was just speaking to what I understand are the difficult choices you have to make here. Obviously, I strongly support the bill, or I wouldn't be authoring it. I would add, too, that keep in mind, this is for the general election, so it would be up from $1.25 million to $2 million for the whole cycle, so it's for the whole 2 years. And I would add, too, that, you know, I have friends, as all of us do, I'm sure, in different parts of the country. And we are lucky in Minnesota that even though races are getting more expensive, or at least the need to spend money is increasing because of the prevalence of independent expenditures, I know that for like offices, for example, I have a good friend, happens to be a conservative Republican in Virginia, who tells me that to run for their House of Delegates there, it normally costs about $120,000. And so we can be thankful, and it's not just because of this money, but I think in large part because of this money, that we aren't having to, we aren't seeing elections spending like that, basically. That's for sure the exception and not the rule. And I think many of us would like to keep it that way, and this helps to do that. But my point was only that I understand that, as with anything in this bill, you have some decisions to make. That's all.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Sun. Okay. No comments. We'll hold this over for possible inclusion in the bill. Representative Bingham, do you want to do yours?
Yes,
Chair, I would move that House File 1608 be laid over for possible inclusion into the State Government Finance Omnibus Bill.
Okay. This
is a technical bill that I'm going to turn over regarding some of the business. It's a housekeeping bill for the Business Services section of the Secretary of State's office, and here to testify or to explain some of the details is Bert Black from the Secretary of State's office.
What?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bingham and members. My name is Bert Black, legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. And this is the Business Service Housekeeping Bill. There are two articles. There are five sections in Article 1 that have fiscal impact. There aren't any sections in Article 2 that have a fiscal impact. The five sections in Article 1, in Section 1 of the bill, this is making the charge for copies of assumed names the same as for all the other business filings. You'll see these are all statutorily set fees, and for some reason, many years ago, we made the fee for assumed names. The charge was $3 for the entire record, and for other business filings, it's $3 for the original filing and $3 for all the subsequent filings. We do 600 of these a year. Writing the computer program to have a different rule would be a lot more than the $1,800 a year that is saved to the customers of the office. We therefore ask that we make this fee, this charge, consistent. Section 2 has a savings effect by $4,000 per year by eliminating a redundant notice to corporations that they've been dissolved. The notice is given in advance to all corporations, and there will continue to be a listing of all dissolved corporations on the Secretary of State website. Section 8 is to clarify that there is no charge for an annual report for a limited partnership, and it also changes the amount charged for a limited partnership name reservation from $50 to $35, so that's a fee reduction. And the reason we're doing that is that if this is the same charge that we charge for other business entities, there are other sections of law under which they can file a name reservation, and almost everybody uses those other sections of law with the lower charge, interestingly enough. There are only approximately 200 persons per year who file the limited partnership name reservation. Therefore, there would be a net reduction to revenues to the general fund of $3,000 per year. And then finally, we have Sections 10 and 12 of Article 1, which affect the Uniform Commercial Code. Section 10 is the section that's been in place for many years that provides that funds in the Uniform Commercial Code account are a revolving fund. This proposal expands the availability of those funds, not simply for the central filing system, but also to pay for online filings and remote payment charges, which are credit card and similar fees. We anticipate that starting in July, as we move to a remote payment system, credit card charges will skyrocket well beyond the ability of our normal budget to handle, and this proposal will actually allow us to avoid imposing an additional charge for credit card charges on UCC and other customers. Section 12 provides that the charge for online UCC filings should now be the same as that for paper filings. Online filings are done only through the Secretary of State. Paper filings are done primarily with county filing offices. The county recorders support making this charge $20 for all filings, and $20 was the charge for filings between 2000 and 2004. And the amount of money raised by the equalization of these charges will pay for what we anticipate will be the credit card costs. If you took all of our, we are aiming towards doing all of our transactions in a remote way, online. Certainly are interested in providing service to those who arrive at physically come to the office or mailing, but online is remarkably popular with the customers, and so if we have to pay a credit card fee for our entire revenue stream, this amount that we're going to raise by the increase is going to offset that credit card fee. And Madam Chair and members, I'll take any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bingham, you know what question I'm going to ask.
In the GovOps committee, we discussed the issue of how the Secretary of State comes to the determination of the fee level, and they said, well, it's set in statute, and we went back and forth on that issue, and I guess Representative Bigham, I'd like to work with you in getting a better idea of why we set the fees at the rate that we do. I have a constituent from my district who was very upset when he just changed the address location of his business and was charged $35. And to him, that seems excessive, and it does to me as well. And so I'd like to see some further movement on that.
Representative Bigham. Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I agree with you, and I think to be able to work on this over the interim and to work in the next session or next session to figure out either a formula or work with the Secretary of State's office on how we can come up with that versus doing something on this bill, which is a housekeeping bill, come up with some sort of formula with the office, and I'd be more than happy to work with you on it.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, the office is interested in doing a more global analysis of the fees, so we would be glad to be in that loop as well.
Madam Chair. Mr. Black, I think that would be really helpful because I know in one of the, I can't remember if it was in this committee or if it was in GovOps, I know that the Secretary of State had mentioned that you're trying to move towards more online services, and I would expect that moving to online should make it much more cost efficient for us to be running things, and I think that's great, but then that also means that our corresponding fees should decrease.
To Representative Anderson, I agree with that too. My only thought on that, and again, we can do this next session, is the cost it would take to upgrade software as the years progress. And I mean, just to keep those in mind too. But this is something that we can discuss in the interim or in next session.
Okay. There are no further questions. We'll hold the spill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Mr. Rhodes, we have a couple of simple bills from the Department of Administration. I'm the chief author of them. Commissioner Bezler. We'll work on that. I'd like to look at House File 2066, the Building Replacement Fund established. We talked about that. And House File 1638. One is actually just the first one, House File 2066. I understand that someone. Warren.
Madam Chair, it's me. I'm Carrie Sukin with the Department of Administration, the Plant Management Division. House File 266 authorizes the department to establish a separate account for the building replacement funds. We currently have the authority and are collecting funds for this purpose. What we're asking for is to establish a separate account to put these funds in.
Any concerns about that or questions about that? Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I don't have the bill.
In the package. 2066. Yes, we're doing this. Okay, right. There's no further discussion, then we'll hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay, thank you very much. The next one is then 1638 on the branch management issue. Commissioner Badgerow.
Madam Chair and members,
This is the establishment of some responsibilities in the Department of Administration pursuant to a Drive to Excellence team recommendation involving a number of agencies as well as the Council of Nonprofits and others. It also parallels some findings of the legislative auditor that some of you may have been briefed on with respect to the state's grant management process. This simply provides a single centralized function where we can simplify the processes, make them more uniform, make them more business disciplined, and ultimately, of course, to make the process easier for those in the nonprofit world who are trying to get grants from the state.
Okay. Are there any questions about this? Well, a couple of comments on the funding of this. Again, looking at some of the things that the Senate has done. Again, looking at how we try and balance out the total funding in our bill, my inclination on this bill is to give some upfront money, and then to fund it from a proportion on each grant. This is common with things that are done in the federal government, where if you have an NIH grant or an NSF grant, there's some money on that. So not to do a total, not to do an additional appropriation to pay the whole thing. We don't have the language or the amount in front of us right now. That's what my intention is. Okay, any questions about this bill? Thank you very much. With no objection, this will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Burns isn't here, is he? Anybody know? It's a simple bill. Try and find it. Or did someone go and try and find it? What? Okay, terrific. Okay. Oh, she went to get one. Okay.
Those are the two people, Burns and Walker.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Did we do your outdoor light pollution bill yet?
No, we haven't yet.
Oh.
Well, I guess we can do that.
Representative?
There's an amendment. The con bill on light pollution, outdoor light pollution restricted. We need an amendment to take off the objection.
Is it?
Well, Representative Walker. Representative Walker.
Madam Chair.
Explain the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 219 is really giving the opportunity for families to concentrate on their families. While we have some employers across the state, not everyone is doing this. It's really expanding the usage of accrued sick time benefits to go beyond a minor child and yourself to include just your parents, your spouse. Hopefully, this amendment gets adopted to adult children and things of that nature, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Representative Wilkes, I know you know there's a pretty horrendously high fiscal note attached to this.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, and I do believe there's a couple of testifiers, and I would like to reserve some time for that afterwards, too. It comes down to a matter of policy. Mind you, this isn't giving new sick time benefits to employees. Fiscal note that you have here, from my understanding, is assuming that state employees will take an additional 3 days of their time that they've already been given. And this is where you get it. It's not that it's new sick time benefits. It's just the assumption that they'll take more time. And so it comes down to this idea, should we really be looking at opportunities for employees to be able to take the time that they've accrued and expanding how they use it to be able to take care of their families when they're in crisis or whatever situation is going on, versus should we just be holding on to this sick time?
Chair and members, my name is Iris Freeman, and I'm here on behalf of the Alzheimer's Association. House File 219 is a recognition that caregiving is a lifespan issue. It doesn't end when our nests are empty, and sometimes adult family caregiving doesn't even wait until our nests are empty. The Alzheimer's Association is so familiar with the stresses of employed caregivers balancing the predictable and spontaneous needs of a loved one with the obligations of our jobs. My purpose today is simply to ask you on behalf of the association to pass House File 219, or to include it, to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus, so that it would begin to allow the use of accrued sick leave to care for our sick or injured adult family as we now can for the care of our sick or injured children. Certainly, from an economic standpoint, informal care is the resource that we have to encourage if there's ever going to be a manageable medical assistance budget. So if we don't shape policy to stand by working caregivers, our state and nation can't afford the consequences. My guess is that you do not want me to review the entire statistical abstract of U.S. data on Alzheimer's disease right now, but it was just released last week, and one interesting figure is that the estimated value of uncompensated family care for dementia patients alone is $1,575,409,648 in 2005 in Minnesota. That's a lot of service, and these are folks who need us to stand by them.
Okay. Any questions about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Blocker. I just want to be sure I've got this right. Is this both in the public and private sector? Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Blocker.
I'm wondering if there'd be anyone that represents any of the business groups to speak of what this might mean to employers. I see that there's a cutoff for the size of a business, but I guess I'm particularly interested in the smaller size businesses and what this might mean in lost hours and what that would mean for the business's operations.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Pepin. A couple different things. One, as you see, this is a bill that came into being in January. A lot of the bills that you will be hearing can't say the same. This is actually the fourth committee that we've had an opportunity to have a bill heard in. The only individuals up until today that had came to me that had some concerns is the department as it relates to the issue that I brought. Unions, a couple of the union folks that I talked to, some of the small business folks that I talked to, none of them have expressed that concern. Today, right before session, the League of Cities expressed some concerns. And I take that back. I misspoke. There is one other entity, and that's the Mayo.
I talked with a representative from the Mayo Clinic who actually had suggested something that made them comfortable with the bill. Mayo Clinic has an incredibly generous sick leave provision. It's 13 weeks. And what they were concerned about is that with this opening up, that you get people, just very much extending them. So what they wanted was some kind of limit, like the more like what the average sick leave of state government or something else was. And so Representative Walker has spoken with them, and they're agreeing to come to some agreement on.
Madam Chair, on that point alone, what I've been told, I've received a letter, and at this time, while they still have concerns, they are no agreement can fix their situation.
Representative Kahn and Representative Walker, I'm just wondering if you had any contact at all with groups like NFIB, the Minnesota Business Partnership, the Chamber of Commerce, if they've contacted you or if you've contacted them about this legislation.
I'm sure Representative Kahn has no. My local radio, they've been in the room on different locations, different buildings.
Okay. I think one of the things you have to point out is that we're not giving any additional, this isn't mandating any different days. It's just allowing a different way of using it. One of the things that I was kind of interested in is in state government, we don't really keep track as whether people have sick children or not. Everyone gets the same amount of sick leave days, whether they have any likelihood of using it or not. I imagine, and I'm not talking about in state government, but in any kind of employment that I've had, I think one knows that there are people who've abused sick leave days, and one knows that there are people who have just been absolutely rigorous in whether they call anything sick leave or not. So I don't quite understand how we're going to have it. You know, I think if we've given people a certain amount of sick leave, kind of assumes that they can take up to that amount of sick leave. And again, this just expands it to the reasons that people would want to do it. So, again, Representative Pepin.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but having worked at a Fortune 5 company myself, I mean, sick leave and vacation leave are not the same. I understand in some companies they are, but in some companies you only take sick leave if you're sick. That doesn't mean you take 25 days of sick leave if you have 25 days. You take 5 days of sick leave. You usually use all of your vacation, but I would say that most people under those circumstances don't usually use up all their sick time. And I understand that there are companies that have that flexibility. I'm just curious, but you know, apparently they're not concerned because they would be here if they were. So that was my inquiry.
Okay. Well, there, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Representative Pepin made me think of something else when we're considering this legislation. Representative Walker, have you had any contact with school districts at all when it comes to this issue? And because I know when they go to the bargaining table and negotiating with the teachers' unions, they're also looking at, okay, what has been the past use of sick leave and so forth when they're determining things like that. Have you had any conversations with them and how this would impact them and their school budgets overall?
Madam Chair,
Representative Walker.
Not directly. It's interesting, the out of the prior to this, the other three committees, as you can see, the only issue that really has come up is negotiations and contracts, not necessarily about the usage of time, per se. And the union representatives, those that would be more concerned than others, haven't expressed any concern moving forward.
Okay. Well, if there's no further discussion, then we'll hold over 219 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Sorry.
No,
four. Yes. Sorry. Back to pre-inclusion.
Madam Chair, and I'll keep my
comment. Larson.
My name is Paul Larson. I introduced myself in the previous bill, and as Representative Walker did testify that the state does have some concerns, and I'm here today to share those with you. I agree with the comments from the other representatives. Sick leave is only to be used when you're sick. We consider it a perpetual insurance policy. You earn 4 hours of sick leave every pay period, approximately 104 hours a year. We've negotiated over the use of sick leave for several years, the last 30 years, with our state employee unions, and it provides for a variety of sick leave for yourself. It also provides for sick leave for your children, whether or not they're living in the household. It also provides for parents and so on, provided they live in the household. And we have a variety of unpaid leave that we allow for our employees as well. The state employee population, and by the way, this bill does apply to all employers,
yes.
Okay, but the state employee
employee population on average, a day of sick leave is $11 million. We've anticipated that the cost of this would be an additional 3 days of sick leave, or approximately $34 million. That while this is money that is funded for positions, it's again lost productivity for people that are not at work. And in addition to that, I think probably one of the biggest concerns that I have with this is that the bill, the way it's crafted, allows an employee to be able to use sick leave under the same standards if they were to use it for themselves. Currently, if you want to use sick leave for others, we base it on reasonable notice and arrangements to be able to work that out. But if you're sick and you can't come to work, you indeed are sick. And in addition to the $34 million, we did an analysis of our 24/7 facilities, which is our veterans homes, our correctional facilities, and our DHS facilities, and most of the time those facilities are operating with bare minimum staffing patterns. And so when someone calls in sick, we have to hire overtime to cover that post. There's two ways of covering the overtime. One is through voluntary overtime, where people have signed up and their willingness to work for the overtime, but we still have to provide the coverage, and if they won't work the overtime, then we have to force someone to stay, which is a real contested issue for us in labor relations with our unions. We do have several provisions on forced overtime, which calls for the least senior overtime to work, but we have calculated that just for the state unit itself, in addition to the $34 million, that we will have an additional $10 million in overtime costs based on the short notice that's been provided to employers. So I understand the personal emotion about this. I have had personal instances of sick leave use myself, but again, I'm giving you the employer perspective, and we believe that this is clearly something that should be brought to the bargaining table. It has been brought to the bargaining table. We have, in my opinion, bargained responsibly with the state employee unions over this, but this would be a huge expansion for our state contracts, and it would be something that would have a significant cost to us as an employer with our state agencies.
Okay.
Thank you.
No further discussion. We'll hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Okay.
It looks like there's another testifier for that bill. Ms. Finn?
Oh, okay.
I would like to hear what Ms. Finn has to say on the Naked Cities.
Madam Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I did speak with Representative Walker this afternoon. I want to note that she is correct. We just brought our concerns to her today, and the reason for that is we had brought her bill before our board of directors and some of our HR managers just recently at their most recent meeting. And they did have a lengthy discussion about it. We learned in that meeting that a number of cities are already offering these benefits and that they do appreciate this effort. However, they would like it to remain voluntary. So for that reason, we would oppose the mandatory nature of the bill.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Burns. Mr. Badgerow.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know I probably shouldn't editorialize until we're doing something, but if there's a nice bill in the legislature, I would nominate, if there's a nicest bill category, I would nominate this for that. Representative Burns.
I really appreciate
doesn't
that.
Doesn't mean we're going to pass it anyway.
No,
just as a general opinion.
Are you talking about the bill or the author, Madam Chair?
Well, obviously, if you have a really nice bill, you got to have a really nice author to go with it. Something no one's ever accused me of.
We've seen your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think this is a good bill. It does two things. It's going to save the state money, and it brings employment to an underemployed sector in our population. persons with developmental disabilities. I had a chance to work with the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities for the past 4 years when I was on the Governor's staff, and I saw the good work that the Director Colleen Wick did as I was able to help the Governor make appointments to the Council. And we have a bunch of folks who are dedicated and look for win-win solutions. And this is one they have come up with, and it has already saved the state a significant amount of money. And the example from the past is our new DHS building, the Elmer L. Anderson building. They had a problem with too much paper. And they were able to get those documents scanned, and you scan documents for three reasons. So you have it available if there's a disaster, so you can retrieve it quicker, which saves the state money, and also it saves on storage costs. Normally, the going rate when the state contracts this, I believe, is $24 an hour for this type of work. When they did the Elmer L. Anderson building, they were able to employ persons with developmental disabilities for, I think it was under $6 an hour. And that saved the state a significant amount of money. All of the individuals receive W-2s and are paying taxes. The money here is not to pay anyone. It's just to promote the program. And I think it's a reasonable amount of money. This is not part of the governor's budget. It is an idea that I've kind of come up with on my own, seeing the good work that the council has done. I passed around three things. One is just an explanation, basically, about what this is, what document imaging is, and what the bill would do. There's also a letter or an article written by Seamus O'Meara, who's the chair of the council, along with Senator Coleman and Congressman Ramstead, supporting this. And finally, there's a page from their website which talks about the Computer World Award they won, which is really a big deal, and it goes to show what a great program this is. And I know already that the Department of Administration is a strong champion of this type of work. I think they do great work there, and that's all I have. If the commissioner has any comments, I'd certainly want to.
Commissioner Badgerow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Dana Badgerow again. One of the real beauties of having this in my department is that it really is off the beaten track. This is wonderful work that this group does. We've done a limited amount of promotion as best our resources will allow. This is a kind of work that this clientele can perform remarkably well. And as Representative Burns mentioned, the award-winning program in the Department of Human Services has saved a tremendous amount of money. The biggest single obstacle we have within governments and actually within the private sector is the awareness that this population exists and can do this work so well. So we think the biggest single thing we need to do is better marketing, better communication, and we're very resource constrained. We have just full-time staff members on this staff today. But again, it is not a governor's recommendation. We will continue to promote it as best we can with limited resources without this appropriation, but this could really help us.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Okay, well then without objection, we'll hold House File 2117 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
I like
turns
your,
out there was an amendment.
I like your committee really a lot. Yes, Madam Chair, there is an amendment. I just wanted to make sure that you have everything while you're making your consideration and going and making your omnibus bill. One of the things that I was not aware, when I seen child, I just assumed child. My son's 19, he's my child. However, what I found out through actually county employees who have contacted me about this particular bill, wanting to make sure adult child was included into this bill. And what I did was council drafted what is in federal law, and this is the language that we spent some time trying to find definitions of adult child, and this is the language.
Okay. I have been given a copy. I didn't realize it hadn't been passed out to everybody.
Sorry,
so we're making copies of that now.
I understand, Representative Walker, you also said in talking about the problems of the short notice, you were going to try and address
yes,
that.
Yes, Madam Chair. If need be, if a 24-hour notice, unless it's an emergency, needs to be added while you're moving into consideration, if that's going to help things get it on the bill, I'm willing to work with you about that.
Okay, Representative Kahn, I just want to be sure we're talking about 219 again, House File 219
yes.
again. I just
yes.
think that should be clear on the
sorry,
table.
Sorry, I thought I was given an amendment, and I thought that everyone had a copy of it. It turns out that they don't. Because I do like people, even though all we're doing is looking at possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, I do like everyone to see as much as possible everything that's going to be included in it, or as I've done for some of them, give some warning about what I or other people intend to do with some of the with the appropriations. I'm sorry, I wouldn't have brought her back so quickly if I had known that we still had to copy the amendment.
I thought the amendment was here, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
Right. As I understand it, again, this is a cleanup of the language which comes essentially from federal law.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is just making sure that adult children can be included. The way that our statute is child is just really with minor children.
Okay. Representative Wolfhard?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Walker. With respect to your amendment, did you offer that to the League or to the NFIB for their comment? Review?
Madam Chair, no, Representative, I did not.
Okay. Well, further discussion will include this Representative
I'm sorry, I just got the amendment. Yeah. Representative Walker, does this mean that the child, does it say here that the child has to actually be living at home, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, no. It would just actually be added on, just like the parents, grandparents, and things of that nature. So, for example, if right now I got a call saying my son was in an accident and I didn't have vacation time, well, for myself, I'd just get to leave. But I'd be able to utilize my sick time benefits to go to the hospital to be with my son.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Walker, just for further clarification, so does this mean if I personally got sick, had the flu, for example, I called my mom, was out in Greater Minnesota, she'd be able to take the day off from work and drive up here and take care of me because I had the flu? I mean, I'll probably call her anyway, but I mean... Does that mean that case? Or?
I do believe so. If you have sick time available. If you don't have any sick time, no.
Madam Chair, Representative
Portman. But that's not how I read the language. At line 1.8 of the amendment, if the child's over 18, they have to be incapable of self-care because of a mental or physical disability. So I don't know if that means that your mom or my mom could come help us and take a time off from work under this statute. Because typically in the federal law and state law, when we refer to disability, we're not talking about temporary disability like being sick. We're talking about disability.
Madam Chair, I think it's supposed to be and or.
Well, Madam Chair...
What? Well, that doesn't make sense.
Madam Chair, Representative Walker, I think the language is better without the amendment if you want adult children, because a child is a child. But if we add this amendment, because of what it has at lines 1.8 through 1.16, it's only adult children who are disabled.
Madam Chair, members.
Representative Walker.
I am, my intent is to make sure that adult children fall in this category. As it relates to the whole intent of House File 219 is being able to utilize the usage of your accrued sick time. I wanted to make it very clear that if you're able to leave it for a spouse, you're able to leave it for an adult child. If you're able to leave it for a grandparent, that you're able to leave it for an adult child. And that's trying to make sure that it was there was clarity in it. Some people's definition of child is quite different.
Well, the problem is Representative Horton is correct. This really does restrict it. If you want to make sure that child includes any child, I think you need to put a period. Put a period after or older after 1.8 and then strike the rest of the amendment.
Madam Chair, I am flexible. And when it comes, my intent is just to make sure that they're adult child. And this is something that was found in the federal statute that was given to me.
Well, okay, I think the thing that we're saying
I'm okay with
is
that
this
Chair.
Would actually go, well, started out by saying that this is what the federal language does. The federal language is much more restrictive than what you're proposing. Federal language doesn't go for a child anywhere, any place. This is the language. It's only for a child who's incapable of self-care. I think you're looking, I think when we're looking at a bill that we may want to restrict, I think this dramatically expands it, and I'm not sure you want.
No, Madam Chair. I prefer not to do the amendment, however, to be able to work with counsel to figure out to make sure that without the language or without some type of language that it's not keeping adult children from being included.
Okay. Let's not put this amendment in, but and you'll work on trying to do something. But then don't refer to the federal. Okay. So we're not
going
to
do
no
that
further
down
discussion.
Here.
No further discussion on 219. Do we have amendments to the one? Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Next bill I'll take up is one of the con bills on light pollution. 446. House File 446. And this bill went to the Energy Committee and then went to the Local Government Committee. Some of the people I've been working with on the DOT, the bill right now that takes out the mandate on local governments. What it just does is it just brings the issue before us, puts a mandate on state-funded lighting, and it calls for a model ordinance to be drafted and returned and given to the legislature. I was also working with people from the Department of Transportation on it, and they suggested this language to make them feel comfortable with eliminating excess costs to the state. So there are one amendment, which is it just cleans up language, takes out some language like obnoxious glare or something like that. No.
Okay.
Oh, we have another one. Okay. All right. Well, I think the League of Cities have contacted me on the League of Small Cities. They have no problems. They're anxious to work on a model ordinance. Department of Transportation, I believe, has no problems with this language added. and then the next, the language on A4 added, and then the language on A5 is just adds some more flexibility and deletes the word oppressive. So I'd like to move that House File 446 be held over for inclusion in the omnibus bill, and along with the two amendments, A5 and the A4 amendment.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm curious about the definition on line 1.20. Light pollution means the night sky glow caused by the scattering of artificial light in the atmosphere. Is that in statute already? Is that from Webster's Dictionary, or where did that definition originate?
It came from the Dutch Skies Association.
Excuse me?
The Dutch Skies, people who have worked on the issue of light pollution. There, let me point out that there are ordinances have been passed by the town of Maplewood, by the Mankato, by Blaine, and Plymouth also dealing with this. And this is common language for that.
Well, Madam Chair, one more definitional, if you could explain. 1.7 to 1.8, night environment. Could you tell me where that is defined? To preserve the night environment.
Those are just words that, you know, it's not the site.
Madam Chair, how do I know what preserving the night environment means, then? I don't know what the night environment is.
That means seeing, you know, it's the same thing like talking about the air environment. It's like clean air. That's the night environment is like the ability to see stars and not have glare in your eyes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. We will include this bill. Will be, and, you know, one of the problems with how we do things these days is that at this point you'd need to know whether the Senate has dealt with it or not. And, of course, we don't at this point. So, still with its amendments, we still go with possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Yes. Okay. Okay. Go now. May have to check it. Yes. Oh. We have a deal forest bill, which is going to need to be amended a little bit, but.
Is it House File 150, Madam Chair?
Yes, House File 150.
I appreciate your consideration, Madam Chair, but given the bills that have been introduced and where we've been going, I would be surprised if this were included, although I appreciate your consideration.
Well, Representative LaForest, what I was going to suggest, unless you would think it would be a level of hypocrisy beyond which the legislature should not stand, that, yeah, I understand. We're not going to include this bill as it's written in this bill this year. But if you want to look at it at some future date, that's kind of warning, we could be willing to say that from now on we're not going to do it. It's up to you whether you would want to do that or not. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be able to go in with the language as it is.
Well, Madam Chair, given our agenda today and the nature of the legislature at this point in crafting legislation that does have a chance of moving forward, and certainly I can look to the future with Mr. Shepherd at some other time. But it brings up a larger discussion, Madam Chair, which we could have at another time or now about, you know, the use of fees, the use of taxes. For example, I've brought this up before, and I don't think the bill will come to this committee or has, talking about a $40 fee increase for a residential real estate license. I mean, my goodness, that's you and I had a different the income. We've had that discussion about real estate agents, but you know, that's a significant increase in the fee structure, for example. And I think sometimes
that gets left out of the debate. We talk about taxes a lot more than we talk about fees. And so, you know, that's certainly, you know, I have every intention. I'd love to implement House File 150, but at the minimum, I certainly wanted to draw some attention to the issue, and one that we need to have going forward as a legislature about the reliance on fees.
Well, would you like to, understanding that we're obviously not going to put this bill as is into this, would you like to have some discussion with Mr. Shepherd about what kind of language that you think would be appropriate so that the legislature is ensured that it has that discussion?
We could, you know, certainly I'm very willing to work with Mr. Shepherd to craft the right kind of language going forward. I mean, certainly we could do that. I would be interested in doing it. As I said, Madam Chair, not to belabor the point, I know we have an extensive agenda today. It is something that we need to look at, certainly. But I think it's, as I said, part of the revenue equation that gets overlooked all too often.
Okay. Representative Portman.
Representative DeLaForest, I would really like to work with you on this because I think it would be useful to have something in statute that says that fees should be related to the service that they're providing and that, you know, we're not setting them in sort of some unrelated standard and then using some excess money for some other purpose. Because it seems like if it costs $35 for Representative Anderson's constituent to have his name changed in the Secretary of State database with whatever they have to do, then that makes sense. But it seems like the fees should be related to what people are getting for them. And so I would love to work with you on that.
And Representative Conant and Representative Portman, you make a good point, and I think that's part of the nature of fees that troubles me. It seems as well that the legislature has a lot more control over taxes than we do over fees. Fees all too often disappear into the bureaucracy and seem to be, at least in my opinion, on the whole, controlled more by the bureaucracy than controlled by the legislature. As I said, I mean, you know, there's a role for fees to play, you know, but what it should be, I think, should be more under our control than I feel is the case at this time. And I feel like we're not in control of the fee structure for the most part. And I know I think we've got some statutory language out there, Mr. Shepherd, that you've talked about trying to control fees. And that also begs the question, you know, who's watching? Who's jacking up the fees? I mean, I don't feel like we've got the right kind of oversight, perhaps. Madam Chair, I'll wrap it up in the interest of time, but I think, you know, you've heard from colleagues here that on a bipartisan basis, maybe as a legislature, we're not as comfortable with what's happening with fees as we ought to be. And so I'm very willing to listen to ideas. I offered the bill. I did have every intention. I'd love to see it become law, but I also had another purpose, and I want to start some kind of discussion about it.
Madam Chair, I believe with Representative De La Forest, Representative Anderson, Representative Portman, and myself, I think that's enough for a subcommittee or some sort of, you know, working group that we can work with Mr. Shepherd on that, because I really agree with what's been said here about that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to not only Representative De La Forest, Hartman, Bingham, everybody around the table. I'll just give an example, and this is again from the energy finance bill. For an initial residential mortgage originator license, $850 is crossed out. $2,550 is the new fee. If you're simply renewing your license, it goes from $450 up to $1,350. Of course, $50 of which is credited to the consumer education account for in the special revenue fund. And, you know, the fee itself is egregious. The whatever this fund is exactly what Representative DeForest was talking about. Who has oversight over the fund? Where are these funds going? You know, who's being educated out of the education account, special revenue? I really think that, you know, for as much as we get blamed, at least we ought to have some of the controls over where some of these things are going and who they're being charged to.
That was one of the points when we tried to make, to put better control over rules. Because we, and I've noticed from past times is that bills are much better. There are no more rules that give departments general authority over rules. But, of course, a fee that's specifically stated in law means that we've agreed to it. The problem is I don't feel comfortable about discussing whether we should. I don't feel comfortable about.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I know.
Mr. Shepard was telling me about the report that the Department of Finance has to submit. And but there is a, Mr. Shepard has told me there are reports that are submitted to the legislature, and Ms. Roberts concurs. But again, we just don't have that same type of control. Who knows how many reports are floating around out there submitted to the legislature? We don't even see them. I would go back and I acknowledge that, and I appreciate the good work of Mr. Shepard and Ms. Roberts. But goodness, we just don't have the same kind of control, and I think we all agree. The fees just seem to get a pass that taxes don't, and I'm troubled by that, and I think that's shared by the committee.
Okay. Well, we're gonna wait for that one. We're gonna wait to discuss the fees and the energy bill. So, if Representative Hilty is here, although I imagine we'll have sufficient discussion of them at later points, we're gonna wait until it's here.
And Chair Representative Hillstrom's in the room. Maybe she'd like to proceed with her bill.
Well, okay. Sure, why don't you give us a discussion of this bill? But this bill, I think I need some greater discussion with Representative Murphy about what this bill.
Madam Chair, I can move.
So.
I can move 1160 for Representative Hillstrom.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, want to tell us what we've had? And then I'll tell members of the committee my concerns with it.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1160 is the fix that is statewide that is comparable to the Duluth bill. It allows for local units of government and school districts to establish trusts to pay post-employment benefits to retired employees, officers. It appropriates money. Representative Biskins has been working on this issue for many years, and I am kind of taking the reins here. With that, I have...
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association, and today I'm actually speaking on behalf of the School Board Association, the county, various county associations, and the League of Cities on this bill. We support House File 1160. The bill does three basic things. It allows for the creation of trusts for the investment of basically what is health and retiree health insurance benefits. It provides that, or it allows the funds that are put in that trust to be invested on a longer-term basis than it could be if you were just using the short-term would be if you were just using the short-term investment laws. It allows it to be invested the same way as you do with your covered covered pension plans. And it validates the 30 or so trusts that were already established by school districts. And then the Attorney General's office said that we didn't have the authority to establish them. And this would validate those trusts and allow them to be invested the same way. This bill is supported by the three organizations. It has been reviewed extensively by the State Auditor's Office and incorporates in several provisions that are requested by the State Auditor. It incorporates in the provisions, or several provisions, that were in the legislative auditor's report and reflects the recommendations in the state auditor's, or the legislative auditor's OPEB report. If I could just go through the bill quickly. The first section basically says that political subdivisions and public entities may establish one of these trusts. They're not required to establish them. It says that they may establish them. Under GASB 45, if you want there to be an offset against your liabilities, you have to establish it and be able to put the money in and invest it. Subdivision 2 says that those trusts can only be used to pay post-employment benefits and can be either revocable or irrevocable, which we'll talk about in a minute. Subdivision 3 specifies as three different options for who could be the trust administrator that would do these investments. One of them would be PERA, one of them would be banks that have trust powers, and one would be insurance companies or agencies which have at least 5 years experience in investment products and services for group retirement benefits, and which have a specialized department dedicated to services for retirement investment products. On page 2, lines 3 and 5, it basically says if you create one using one type of trust administrator and you decided you don't like that, you can change to another administrator. Subdivision 4 provides for how these accounts will be maintained. I would particularly draw your attention to the language that is on page 2, lines 14 to 18. This is the specific language that was requested by the State Auditor's Office, and it provides that the trust administrator must report to the political subdivision or public entity on the investment returns of invested trust assets and on all investment fees or costs incurred by the trust. The annual rates of return, along with investment and administrative fees, must be disclosed in the political subdivision or public entity's annual financial audit in the manner prescribed by the state auditor. The state auditor will have a form. This will make all of these fees and these returns transparent, and it will make them so that you can look at the comparability between the different options that are out there. Subdivision 5 provides how these monies can be invested. If we go through PERA, it would be invested by the State Board of Investment under Section 11A14 and be subject to the policies and procedures established by the State Board of Investment. That's the language that Mr. Bicker requested for that. If you go through a trust administrator other than PERA, which would be either the bank or the insurance company, it must be invested by a registered investment advisor, a bank investment trust department, or an insurance company or agency retirement investment department. For the trust assets that are invested by the State Board of Investment, the investment restrictions would be the same as on the State Board of Investment. If they're invested by one of the other trust administrators, they can be invested either in the short-term investments that are under Chapter 118A or in the same way as all your other covered pension plans, like your firefighter plans and the rest of those are invested. Political subdivision can provide investment direction to a trust administrator in compliance with the applicable trust document. For instance, you can have different allocations of types of things that you want to invest in. They can give them that sort of direction. Subdivision 7, for the first time, well, Subdivision 6 puts a limit on the amount that you can put in these trusts, and it can't exceed the amount of your actuarial liability. So you can't take all the money you've got in the world and put it in there and invest it at a higher rate. You can't go more than 100% of what your liability is going to be for retiree health insurance. Sub 7 allows you to do these trust accounts in two different ways. You can have a revocable account. If you have a revocable account, the money must be used to pay retiree benefits. However, you are allowed to take money out that exceeds 100% of that liability if one of these four tests that are listed here are met. And these are on lines 315 to 322. If there's been a change in state or federal law that affects the amount of your liabilities, for instance, if the feds changed the age for qualifying for Medicare from 65 to 55, you would have almost no liability. If there's been a change in the demographic composition of the political subdivision's employees eligible for post-employment benefits, if you had 10 people that qualified, and seven of them die some year, there would be a change in the demographic composition. If there's been a change in the provisions or terms of the post-employment benefits, including the portion of the cost that eligible employees must pay to receive the benefits, or if there are other factors that have a material effect on that political subdivision's or public entity's actuarially determined liabilities. In that case, you can take out the money that's over 100% of your liability, but you still need to leave at least 100% in those accounts. The second option begins on 3.27, and this would allow you to comply with GASB 45, and this would be to create irrevocable accounts. There, you would put the amount in there that's needed to pay post-employment benefits, and whenever you can't take the money out until everybody that qualified basically is dead. If it comes time to withdraw the money, you either go through the procedures that have been established by PERA or the procedures that have been established under the applicable trust document. The political subdivision or the public entity that creates the trust is the one that ensures that the withdrawals comply with the requirements of this section. You'll recall there was some discussion as to whether we were going to be making PERA liable if the money was withdrawn. This cures that problem and puts the liability back on the political subdivisions where it belongs. Subdivision 8 basically provides that these trusts are not subject to claims by either creditors of the state or the political subdivision or the trust administrator or the employees. This is language that was suggested in the legislative auditor's report. Section 2 of the bill is a validation of the 30-plus trusts that were established prior to June 6, 2006. On June 6, 2006, the Attorney General's office came out with an opinion that said that we didn't have the authority to establish these trusts. Whether correct or not, that opinion is binding at least on school districts, and that's who had created all these, so we had to stop doing them. This would allow those to continue to accept new funds. They could invest the funds at a higher rate, and it gives them until January 1, 2008 to bring any trust documents or procedures into compliance with the general law that's in Subdivision 1. This act will be effective the day following final enactment. The reason that it's really kind of critical that this get adopted this year is this is in effect for the big political subdivisions as of this year. It's in effect for the big school districts as of July 1 of this year. They need to have this in place if they're going to be able to take advantage of this option. The real benefit of this is that if you have the money and you put the money aside, the money will be there, and to the extent that you could invest it at the higher rate, that will reduce the amount of your liabilities. This doesn't replace the Duluth bill. That had other provisions in it. This is the bill that would basically apply to everyone else.
Representative Hillstrom, you know, we've had some questions about this. The Duluth bill was presented to us as an emergency because one could see that it was going out. And I think the question we asked was, what was the emergency with... I don't know if other members of the committee are totally comfortable with everything that's been said about this bill. I'd feel much more comfortable if the Pension Commission were to spend a certain amount of time over it, because this is a very big expansion, I think, of our post-employment public benefits and so forth. And, the Duluth bill was much more tightly constructed and was much more, for example, only set up an irrevocable trust, I believe. And this is, you know, I'd really like to have a lot of discussion about why, whether this very loose status of this is a good idea. And as I said, and one of the things that's been suggested
then when we, in a conversation with Representative Murphy, Chair of the Pension Commission, whom I believe feels the way I do, and you know, I'd like to go talk to people like Representative Smith, who has a lot of experience in pensions too. But the question is, did we have to do this right now? Could this wait until we could give the Pension Commission could give it its the kind of study I think it needs. It needs to make me comfortable with it. So one of the things that we thought, and then you brought up the issue of the problem that people had already gone around establishing these and they suddenly told that they couldn't. So I think one of the solutions that we looked at, the possibility of doing that, is to Section 2, which is the validation section, is to make Section 2 effective immediately following final enactment, but to make Section 1 not effective for another 2 years, July 1st, 2009, that the legislature did, so people like the Pension Commission did have an ability to look at it. Would that work?
Madam Chair, if I could actually have Tom Dean, reply to that, because I do know that the validation is a very large concern.
Yes.
But maybe Mr. Deans could talk about the other pieces.
Madam Chair, let me first just say one thing. This bill doesn't change our obligation to pay the retiree health benefits one whit. If we're required to pay retiree health care, we have to pay it whether this bill passes or not. It does not change that at all. GASB 45 is effective for the big political subdivisions that have, and it's based on how much you spend, how much they spend, what their budget is. But the big ones, most of the big metro school districts, all the big metro cities, all of them, and the outstate centers, it'll be effective for them this year. To the extent that you don't allow them to do it, they will not be able to reduce their benefits or their liabilities by the increased interest costs. They can still put the money. Well, they can't establish the trust, so they can't do anything. They can put the money into an account the same way they can do now. We're not required to establish these trusts. This just allows us to do it and to invest at the higher rate. If you don't want us to do it and say that we can't do it so that we have to invest at the lower rate during that time that you give it consideration, I guess that would be up to you. I know our people, many of our people feel pretty strongly about this, but that would be a legislative decision. And I would guess that they'll tell you how they feel about that if that happens. But any of your big political subdivisions, those of you that have any of them, are not going to be pleased if you do it that way. But that's the legislature. That's in the legislature's domain. But it's only a question of allowing them to set this up so that they can invest at the higher rate. If you don't think that that's the right thing to do. And let me also just say, because there's also another little bit of confusion here. If we take the amount of money that like a school district or a county or city has, and if it's like this, in most of them the amount that you're talking about is about like this. Now in Duluth it's bigger, but in most of them the amount that we're talking about is the thumbnail compared to a deal that's this wide. You know, we invest billions of dollars of school district money today. This is only talking about a little piece of it, but that would be the legislature's determination. We would encourage you to approve this.
Well, if it's a little piece of it, the issue then it's not really very important to their total financial picture.
It's important to this part of their financial picture. They still have to pay those. They still are going to have to show that on their balance sheet as a liability as these new accounting regulations go in. You didn't pass these accounting regulations. GASB passed them. That, you know, we didn't ask for it either. the Governmental Accounting Standards Board pass these and say that we have to account for this stuff this way. And we don't have any control over that. We don't get a vote or to get necessarily even to have Gatsby listen to us.
You know, my sense is that I still want pension commission staff and pension commission to look at this. And you don't really have time to do it. And I'm reporting to the chair of the pension commission this week. So, I guess I'd like to hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, with the likelihood that we still may try and do that. Validate. I really feel for the ones who did something and didn't know what they were doing, and I certainly like those people to be told that what it's leaving. But I would like to look at what kind of reporting we want on this. We put some extra reporting requirements on the Duluth one. I came back and wanted those further relaxed, so we further, after originally agreeing with them, so we further relaxed them. But we don't even have those, that language in this bill at this time. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I just want to say thank you for your efforts on this area. When I was first elected, even in December, I was contacted by my school districts in my area very concerned about this issue because they want to make sure that they have the capability to plan ahead. And, you know, I applaud them because they are thinking ahead about what these liabilities mean to not only their retirees, but also their current staff members and how that could impact their overall funding structure that they have. And so they were very concerned about it. And I think the sooner that we can get on board on this and address this issue, the better off that we would be. And even though I understand your concerns, Madam Chair, I just think that we would be losing a year if we do not, you know, take advantage of this now and get a head start on it. Because there's a lot of areas that actually need to catch up that haven't done that so far. So I want to thank you for your efforts on this bill.
Yeah. It's also pointed out that this bill doesn't affect our fiscal balance and it's met the deadline. And we can see what the so we can actually just pass it anytime in the next 2 weeks too. We want to do it separately.
That is correct, Madam Chair. And so I guess I would be happy to work with you and Representative Murphy or whoever else we need to work with to make certain that we're able to possibly deal with this issue.
Yes. At the minimum, I would like to certainly get a memo on this from the Pension Commission staff and a side-by-side comparison with the list to see how it's different from the Duluth issue, which seemed to have gotten, you know, Duluth went through a different committee. It went through Government Operations Committee and it went through.
Right, right.
Did it also go through local government too?
It did represent, okay. Chair, and they actually have two separate funds as well. So in addition to dealing with the post-employment benefit, it also had another issue as well. And so I'd be happy to work with staff to get that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, then do we need a motion to recommend that the bill be passed and re-referred to finance?
No.
If you want to travel separately? No.
We're not going to have it travel separately quite yet. It may travel separately and it may go in our bill. It doesn't need to do it.
It's met deadline regardless of whether we pass it out. Okay.
Madam Chair, okay. I might ask, when is your bill due to be finished? Being constructed?
April 2nd.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. I really wanted to do the actually this. Okay, so we're going to hold.
Okay,
do one of two things, or both. We keep it in the omnibus bill, or send it out after we've had time to
ask the Pension Commission staff and Pension Commission for their opinion.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
Without a formal Pension Commission meeting.
Okay, actually, I'm going to recess the meeting for a half an hour or so.
Flipping and looking confused.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, the 7 days, I think, reflects the bill as introduced, and then it was changed to be 7 weeks in the policy committee.
Thank you.
The final section of the bill that has a fiscal impact is Section 39. This section does two things, and the second one is the one that has the fiscal impact. Currently, if you all file a campaign finance report late, you're assessed a fee every day that it's late. That's not true at the local level. And so there are often local candidates who don't file the reports, and the local government send letter after letter, please send in your report, please send in your report. And the only recourse they have is to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So, and even if a candidate then files the report a day or two before the hearing, the county is still charged for the cost of the hearing, which is having a great impact on local budgets. So what this bill does is it allows, it imposes a $10 late fee per day up to $200, and then it says the only fee that will be paid to the Office of Administrative Hearings if they're brought into the process is this up to $200 fee. And the Office of Administrative Hearings has indicated that that is not enough to cover their costs, so there would be a cost to them. Although I don't think that's necessarily reflected in the fiscal note.
I'm glad to hear that about that we do go after the late filing. I actually had a candidate who, against me at one time, what year, who hadn't filed his report, and then before they really went after him, he died. and the staff actually, following the letter of what they were supposed to do, said that they should go after his estate for the fine on not filing the report. And fortunately, the people who make up the board who decided that they didn't have to do that. So I was very glad. I was checked out for me whether I was happy with them not going after his estate, and I was. So.
Madam Chair, I'm surprised.
He was one of the nicer candidates who ran against me. He didn't do anything.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there is another provision in here that I think is reflected in the fiscal note, and that is that we're replacing the HAVA complaint process. However, this is a cost, since it's less than $3,000, it's a cost that our office has realized that we could absorb, and so that's why I didn't mention it in the run-through of the bill.
Okay. Are there any questions about House File 1110? Okay. Representative Anderson.
I know I'm on the curve here, so it's hard to see me.
That's all right. People keep looking out.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty. I think that we had this conversation in the GovOps committee, but I just want to bring it up again. When it comes to the online registration of folks, how are we really guaranteeing that they are who they say they are? And I'm just concerned in general that we're opening ourselves up to greater voter fraud and potential for it. And what kind of safety measures are you going to have in place to protect against that?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't think that the online voter registration opens us up to any issues that we don't have currently. If I fill out a voter registration card and mail it in, there's nothing to say that Representative Hilty didn't fill out the voter registration card and mail it in. So although he did not, of course. I think that, filling out a voter registration application online, we would still make sure that the driver's license number, age, and name match with what is on file with the Department of Public Safety with the Driver's License Division. We would still mail you a postcard to your address, a non-forwardable postcard to verify that you really do live there. So I think that all of the same safety precautions are in place. It just would make it easier for some voters who expect online service and currently don't get it.
Madam Chair, Ms. Frazier, I think that you brought up an even greater concern for me, that maybe that we do need to change how we do this overall to make sure voter fraud doesn't happen, even on the mailing side of things. Because I could just think of, you know, folks all the time rip off the federal government and the state government when it comes to benefits that an individual receives by claiming that their spouse is maybe still alive or their father or mother is still alive when in fact they're dead and they commit fraud that way. So, I mean, I think that you just raised actually a greater concern that I have now. Maybe we need to look at tapering back rather than expanding what we're doing currently just to make sure that we protect the system of voting in Minnesota.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, with voting, of course, there isn't the financial incentive for fraud that there may be in these benefits.
Not directly.
In addition, we do get updates from the Department of Health on deaths in Minnesota. And so we do check our records, see if someone is registered, and mark them as deceased. If they showed up in the polling place, I think there would be quite a few questions.
Madam Chair, that's assuming that they've been actually reported as being deceased. And that's the point that I was getting across, is that people do commit fraud without reporting that someone has died and so forth. So I think it still has the question of, are we making sure that we're maintaining the integrity of our voting system?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the person would still need to come into the polling place and swear that they are who they say they are, sign in, or vote through an absentee ballot, in which case we're doing a signature match.
Okay. If I might, Representative Anderson, also keep in mind that the statewide voter registration system is coordinated with reporting from the Department of Health. That is one of the things that they report to the Secretary of State. So I don't know how that works in other agencies where there might be some potential for misrepresenting a death, but I don't think that that would apply in this case.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I remember when we were debating the voter ID law in 2005 or 2006, or probably both, there were all these concerns raised about voter fraud, and we don't want to have voter fraud. And if I recall correctly, there are very few cases of voter fraud. And so when we're legislating on how to make it easier for people to vote, I think we shouldn't react to a problem that we don't have evidence exists.
Any other discussion? Okay. So for the discussion, then, House File 1110 will be held over for inclusion in the omnibus. Representative Hilton. Next one.
House File 1223. Mm-hmm. Now I similarly move that House File 1223 be brought before the committee and
considered
for possible inclusion in the
omnibus
finance.
So moved. Representative
Hedges. Thank you, Madam Chair. This House File 1223, as you observed, is a much simpler bill than the 1110 that we just considered, particularly when we are regarding its fiscal implications. What it does is provide for some additions and alterations to how we register students within the state. This was a bill that was brought to me by the Voting Rights Coalition, Mr. Cooper from the coalition is here. I don't know if he wishes to testify or not, but he's available to answer questions.
Yes. Is there any questions? Any questions about House File 1222? Representative Ames.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilty, I wonder if you remember back to when we heard this bill in government operations. Remember we had the conversation about the universities, and at that time you hadn't had a chance to talk to the universities about how this would be implemented. And I was just curious. I know you had said that you were going to work with me on this issue. I didn't know if you were able to address those concerns that I expressed at that time. Of
Yes, sir.
I believe Mr. Cooper has been pursuing that question.
Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, Scott Cooper with the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition. Representative Anderson, we have had conversations in the past with many post-secondary institutions. Recently, we've had a conversation with the University of Minnesota about this. We haven't been in contact with MinSCU about it. They were mainly concerned, all of them in our conversations over the last few years, that we were not putting the burden on them to develop these lists and determine what precincts their students live in. And so that's why it's been constructed in this way, so that that burden actually falls on the Secretary of State's office, which is where the fiscal note for this comes in, because they have agreed to take that on, and that will be some cost to them.
Madam Chair, the concern that I expressed was regarding the language on page 1, and it's talking about institutions that do not consider student addresses to be public information under applicable federal and state privacy laws. And the concern that I had raised is that there are a lot of institutions that consider this data to be private. And so how many universities and colleges are we talking about that are actually going to be participating in this? And that was the conversation that I hope that you guys would have had with the different entities involved in this process. And it doesn't sound like you had a chance to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we've had that conversation with the University of Minnesota only. They do not consider this to be private information. They consider the list of their students to be public information, so they would be participating in this as it's... There are two different ways it's provided for here. One is as an opt-out, and the other is as an opt-in. Since they consider this to be public information, there would be an opt-out for students to say they don't want to be included in the list. Any other campuses, and I'm sure there are some that consider this to be private information, I would assume many of the private colleges do, they would be able to say their list is private and would give their students then the option to opt in. So we've tried to account for it either way.
Madam Chair, so you've had no conversations with the MinSCU system at all, just the U?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Hilton.
To that point, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we will pursue that. We've been kind of busy in the last couple of weeks, but that's something that certainly is possible, and we will do that.
Okay. Any other questions about the bill? Okay. Hearing no other questions, we'll hold over House File 1223 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Last bill on the list today. Okay. The last bill on the list today is House File 1618, which I'm the chief author of, dealing with domestic partners of state employees providing health insurance benefits if they're also made available to spouses. And Mr. Cooper is here to testify for this bill and why we need it. Mr. Cooper.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Scott Cooper representing Outfront Minnesota. We're in favor of this for a number of reasons. I'll try to keep it short and focused on the fiscal impact of the legislation. Just a piece of history first. As you may recall, the state of Minnesota offered domestic partner health care benefits to its employees, to your employees, for a brief time in 2002 and 2003 as a result of the collective bargaining agreements between the various unions representing the state employees employees and the Ventura administration. At the time, there were, I believe, 84 state employees of the, I believe at that point, 55,000 state employees that signed up for the benefit, and the cost to the state was estimated by the Commissioner of the Department of Employee Relations to be about $200,000 a year. As you know, what happened with that is that the legislature then said that that these benefits should not be collectively bargained. We got that message pretty clearly from the leadership of the House of Representatives and from then Majority Leader Tim Pawlenty, who said that this was not a matter to be collectively bargained, that this was the governor overstepping his bounds, and that it was a major policy decision and therefore should be decided by the legislature. So we are following that advice and bringing the matter to the legislature and asking you all to resolve it. Because of that position taken by the House of Representatives, the contracts were not ratified as they had been negotiated in accordance with the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. Instead, the legislature chose to take all of the other provisions of the contracts, aside from the domestic partner benefits, and write them into statute and pass them. That was very disappointing, especially to those public employees who work hard for the state and got this benefit for a short period of time and had it taken away from them and their families. I talked in the policy committee, and I won't go into it in detail here, about why this is a fair thing to do, because it is unfair treatment to not offer these benefits when some employees sit next to their coworkers in the next office or the next cubicle, and they can get health insurance coverage for their spouse. Other employees who are not married cannot get these benefits for their lifetime partners. The fairness issue is only one of the reasons why you ought to do this. The second reason is that it is, we think, good business practice. Apparently the private sector also believes that is the case. There are over 350 private sector employers in Minnesota, or with employees in Minnesota, that offer domestic partner benefits to their employees. These include companies like 3M, AT&T, Best Buy, Blockbuster, Ceridian, Ecolab, Ford Motor Company, Quest, Prudential, Office Depot, United Health Group, Walgreens, Wells Fargo, Excel, Xerox, the list goes on and on. There are also a number of state governments that do this currently, including our neighbor to the south, Iowa. There are also across the country a long list of city, county, and school districts, governmental units that offer these benefits to their public employees. I imagine they don't do it just to be nice to their employees. I imagine they do it because they would like to be competitive in attracting and retaining the best and brightest employees. We would think the state of Minnesota would want to do the same thing. Our final reason for why we think you ought to do it is that it is not difficult to do. There is not a lot of difficulty in administering this. It is not particularly expensive. The Department of Employee Relations under the Ventura administration created forms for employees to fill out, affidavits for them to sign, lists of documents they would have to produce to sign up for the benefit. Did not have any trouble administering the benefit. Didn't seem particularly difficult for them to do. I would hope that we could do the same thing at this point in time. A couple last words about some concerns you will hear raised. One of them is that the cost will go up considerably, that this is more expensive now because more employees will want to join. I believe the current fiscal note you're going to see is something like 380 employees signing up. So I want to applaud the current administration for recruiting a lot of gay and lesbian employees, because that's apparently what has happened. But for whatever the cause for that increase in the number of employees who might sign up for it, I think we should not overinflate it in our minds. There are great disincentives for people to participate in this program. Unlike getting benefits for your spouse, if you get benefits for your domestic partner, all of the employer's contribution is considered imputed income and is taxed. So presumably you would not want to take that on if you had some other way of getting health insurance benefits for your partner. There's also not a great deal of concern about fraud, I don't think, because this question was raised in the policy committee. Couldn't someone just sign up and have their roommates join them on their health insurance, claiming that they were a domestic partner? And our response would be that yes, if you wanted to come out as gay or lesbian in your workplace, commit criminal fraud and risk prosecution by your employer, and then pay this additional tax penalty, then yes, you could probably do that, but that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I guess I will leave it at that and answer any questions that you may have.
also passed out an amendment which was also put on in the Senate, and this amendment will also make this available to, at their discretion, a local government unit if they so please. And the reason for putting this on at this time is, in fact, at some point some local units of government had done this, and the court said that it was not allowed, and one of the reasons they gave was that because the state did not do this. So, Mr. Cooper?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to add, now that you have added or offered to add that amendment to the bill, I would like to just say that the language for state employees has been endorsed by AFSCME and the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees and IFO, the three largest bargaining units for state employees. And the local unit language, which you just offered, has been also endorsed by the League of Cities and also by the Minnesota Association of Small Cities.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, is there any further discussion on the bill? If there's no further discussion, then both... Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Sorry. Yes, certainly. I'm going to incorporate both the amendment and the bill into the omnibus.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jared Jordahl with the Department of Employee Relations. I'll be quite brief. Mr. Cooper, I assume inadvertently misspoke on one point. The previous history with domestic partner benefits, the annualized cost was approximately $400,000 rather than $200,000.
I'm sorry. I think what he did say was that it was $220,000 for the period of time, which was 6 months. So
I may have misheard him. I apologize.
You're both correct.
We merely wish to convey what was, in fact, said, that we see this as a collective bargaining issue. And I'm prepared to answer any questions about the fiscal note.
I think the problem that we have, Mr. Jordahl, is that when we did see it as a collective bargaining unit, the legislature then came back after it had been collectively bargained and said, no, it was a legislative unit. So if we really get a note that it's a total collective, somewhat, I don't know who can say that since it was collectively bargained and then taken away. If someone could assure us that it was collectively bargained, we'd be perfectly happy to leave it in place. So that's my thoughts, at least. Any other questions of Mr. Jordahl or Mr. Cooper? Okay, so no further discussion. The amendment in the bill will be included, held over for inclusion, possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Mm-hmm. I think we have the minutes. Representative Hilty moves the minutes of March 22nd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, so the meeting tomorrow is at 8:30. It's in the, like, to lose all our good 8:30 a.m. And it's in room 300 South. Hopefully we'll finish them. There are two things that are definitely on the agenda. One is Military Affairs never gave their full presentation to us on their budget, and they were all out of town today. So Military Affairs is coming tomorrow. And then I have the pay equity bill, which we held over until tomorrow because there was someone from the business community who wanted to speak against it, couldn't be here until tomorrow. And the lobby asked me to hold it over until then. So, well, always like to hear everybody. And then there are three other bills that have been referred to us since. The rate we're going, sorry, this is much faster than I expected. For all these things to do. No, I'm sorry that I didn't schedule more, or looks like we should be okay, maybe even by session tomorrow. And then the next plan is to get the bill turned around as quickly as possible and get a draft bill out to all members by Wednesday. And then we're going to have Wednesday, then we're going to have testimony and full markup. If there's any outside testimony, and full markup on Thursday. Ultimately, the completed bill will then go out Friday. Okay. Hope we can do it. Thank you very much. Thanks for your cooperation. The meeting is adjourned.